You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions, including a 10% pay cut, in an effort to help the airline deal with its financial problems. ATA is the 10th largest airline in the U.S. It has sold some of its operations at Chicago Midway and New York's LaGuardia airports to AirTran Holdings for $87.6 million. ATA says there will be minimal impact on passengers while ATA reorganizes its business. Layoff of 156 workers was announced by the airline last Thursday. United Airlines is shifting 650 telephone reservation jobs to India. Earlier this year, United outsourced 200 call center jobs to Nova Scotia and is planning to outsource more jobs at its Denver call center.
Norwegian oil workers who have been on strike for close to 4 months are back to work today. Members of the Federation of Oil Workers Union went on strike in July against the Norwegian Shipowners Association seeking job security. More than 200 workers began the strike, barely impacting the production of the world's third largest oil exporter. Unwilling to negotiate, the association locked down more than 200 other employees out of retribution. The union replied with close to 200 more workers striking on a major oil platform. The Norwegian government, who had the power to step in and force arbitration, chose to let the two sides duke it out on their own. However, when the association threatened to extend the lockout to more than 94 oil and gas service vessels by November 8th, the government was forced to step in. Workers returned to work today, preventing further possible cutbacks in the country's oil production. Stakes have been raised at two of Atlantic City's casinos currently involved in a strike, saying they will begin hiring replacement workers to fill positions. Seeking better wage and benefit terms, as well as a three-year contract, more than 10,000 workers, represented by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, walked off the job October 1st. Both sides say that talks are ongoing, but two of the four hotels currently on strike, Harrah's and Caesars, have started running ads in local papers seeking workers. David Strau, a spokesman for Harrah's, says the hotel has no choice. Dee Taylor, the Unite Here executive president of gaming, calls the move nuclear war and says it will just prolong the strike. Harrah's ad says that the hotel is seeking permanent replacement workers.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. The AFL-CIO says job outsourcing is accelerating. Some 406,000 jobs will be exported to cheap overseas labor markets in 2004. That compares with 204,000 3 years ago. Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Washington have all been hit hard by jobs loss. Ohio has lost nearly 1 in 6 of its manufacturing jobs. Since 2001, America has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs and 850,000 professional service and information sector jobs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I had survived two previous rounds of layoffs, and then the third round got me. They wiped out my whole department. I was forced to stop paying credit card payments. I had to file bankruptcy. I had to be rushed to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy, for which I'm not insured. How can we be the only westernized country without national health care? I can't believe that this is the best we can do. There's got to be a better way. I'm voting for John Kerry.
Move On Pack is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
You might have heard the news that George W. suffered the embarrassment of having the Crawford, Texas newspaper endorse his opponent. You know you're in a heap of political hurt when your hometown paper rejects you. This news story was an amusing novelty, but it's really much bigger than that. For the editorial by the Lone Star Iconoclast is the best reason, best written piece I've yet read about why George W. should be rejected. It leads off like this. Few Americans would have voted for George W. 4 years ago if he had promised that, as president, he would empty the Social Security Trust Fund by $507 billion to help offset fiscal irresponsibility and at the same time slash Social Security benefits, cut Medicare by 17% and reduce veterans' benefits and military pay, eliminate overtime pay for millions of Americans and raise oil prices by 50%. Give tax cuts to businesses that sent American jobs overseas and, in fact, by policy, encourage their departure. Give away billions of dollars in government contracts without competitive bids. Involve this country in a deadly and highly questionable war and take a budget surplus and turn it into the worst deficit in the history of the United States, creating a debt in just 4 years that will take generations to repay. These were the elements of a hidden agenda that surfaced only after he took office. The publishers of the Iconoclast are not a bunch of lefty Bush haters. Indeed, they endorsed George in 2000. And the tone of this 04 editorial is not one of partisan glee, but of disappointment and sadness, saying repeatedly that he let us down. This is Jim Hightower saying, in the past, Bush has told voters who are unsure about him to listen to Texans like those in Crawford, who he says know him best. To read the full text of this powerful editorial by some Crawfordites who truly do know George, go to iconoclast-texas.com.
Well, Mr. Quentin, I have your loan application here. I see you want to finance one of our big screen TVs.
Oh, yeah, I love that TV.
Of course you do. The thing is, your credit report has a few hiccups or bumps.
Well, bumps, yes.
What we call red flags or warnings.
You see, I can...
Actually, you have huge gaping chasms of incredibly bad decision-making.
Okay, I can explain.
I mean monumental credit mistakes. I mean, phenomenally ridiculous, laughable, really. I mean, oh, Mr. Quentin, oh, I gotta frame this one.
Before you go for a loan, be prepared with Score Power from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score. All for just $14.95. It's the first step to getting the things you want. So check out Score Power at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Get the power. Score Power at Equifax.com.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, less than a week and counting, 495 days since Joe Wilson's wife was outed. However, only 6 days until regime change. Interesting times. You know, 490. A lot of Democrats, actually. A lot of people on the left, as it were. A lot of people on the left were expecting that this might be the Democratic October. Actually, a lot of perhaps some Republicans were concerned that this might be the Democratic October surprise. The indictment of members within the Bush administration over the treasonous, traitorous act, to quote George Bush Sr., of outing not just a CIA officer, Valerie Plame, but bringing down one of the CIA's major international counterterrorism operations. Valerie Plame was heading up at what looked like a multinational corporation that was selling weapons to terrorists in the black market. And when she came down, of course, the whole organization came down, including agents all around the world, many of whom may have been killed. We don't know. The government won't tell us. And when George Bush is asked, are we ever going to find out who the traitor is in your administration, the senior administration official who outed her? And, of course, you know, this investigation, there was supposed to be some results by October. When Bush is asked about it...
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official... Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, let's see what happens over the next 6 days. Frankly, boy, it would be amazing. It would be amazing. But I am not encouraged. But time will tell. We will see. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on terrestrial radio stations, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org with archives at White Rose Society and at tomhartman.com, where you can also drop into our live chat room and participate. I hang out there during the breaks and converse with some of the wisest minds on all of the Internet. Sometimes some of the finest little tidbits that I share with you, in fact, are handed off to me from folks in the chat room. It's really good. And every now and then, if I kind of get off course a little bit, they'll say, hey, you know, here's a factoid you hadn't considered. It's great. It's really great. I encourage you to drop in and say hi. The good citizens of Great Britain and many British countries or British-affiliated countries, nations around the world, members of the United Kingdom, past and present, who are able to receive BBC programming. Last night, were treated to a program. It's a regular program. It's called Newsnight on BBC. We're treated to a regular program, which it's unlikely Americans will see. Just for those of you, I know we have some listeners in the United Kingdom. In fact, a couple of them regularly drop into our chat room. We've had people call into the program from the UK. We've had people call into the program from Dubai and from Kuwait, from Australia, from Austria, from Germany, France. Anyhow, I know we have some English, some British listeners. For you, it's old hat. And I apologize for the redundancy to those of you who are listening in England on the web stream. To our American listeners, this is something that the rest of the world heard last night. Much of the rest of the world heard last night, and you didn't. And so I thought I would just share a little piece of it. Here's the intro to the BBC Newsnight program from last night. This, of course, their intro music.
Tonight's Newsnight has obtained a secret document from inside Bush headquarters in Florida, pointing to a plan to stop some Democrats casting their vote in this key battleground state. After the shambles of election 2000, we wondered why this private detective was lurking outside the polling station where early voting was taking place.
The Republicans, once again, are trying to intimidate African-American voters.
So that was the intro, and then they went through a couple of other stories that they were going to talk about in the course of the hour, and then they came back and they opened the story as follows. This BBC's Newsnight program last night.
Good evening. Allegations about vote rigging and voter fraud are among the oldest traditions of American democracy and not confined to any one political party. Historians still raise questions about whether Lyndon Johnson really swung the vote in Texas for Kennedy in 1960, and if so, how? But after the mess in Florida 4 years ago, with the opinion polls now on a knife edge, Newsnight wanted to find out if things are likely to be any better this time round. In fact, we uncovered something quite extraordinary, evidence pointing to a new Republican plan which could bring voting to a halt in some black and traditionally Democrat areas of this pivotal state. Greg Palast now reports on a bizarre political world in which private eyes secretly film voters and voter registration forms are forged.
And then they go on into the program. The program runs 17 minutes. I certainly can't play it on the radio, but I can tell you this from BBC News. Newsnight, of course, has a website. If you go to bbc.co.uk, you can track it down. The URL is actually rather humongous. But the headline, New Florida Vote Scandal Feared, and this, again, BBC News, this by Greg Palast, who's the award-winning, he won the same award I did, the Project Censored Award, and national best-selling author. He wrote The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. But for years before he became known in the United States as an author, he has worked for BBC, even though he's an American. And here's the headline. It's very straightforward. A secret document obtained from inside Bush campaign headquarters in Florida suggests a plan, possibly in violation of U.S. law, to disrupt voting in that state's African-American voting districts, a BBC Newsnight investigation reveals. Two emails prepared for the executive director of the Bush campaign in Florida and the campaign's national research director in Washington, D.C., contain a 15-page so-called caging list. Now, what, you may ask, is a caging list? Well, it turns out in Florida, see, this is actually illegal in many states, but it's legal in some states and it's legal in Florida. In Florida, a political party can have their hacks inside the voting booth, inside the polling place, inside the place where you go in to vote, not in the booth itself. And when somebody walks up and says, I'd like to, I'm here to vote, my name's on the list, even if their name's on the list, that party hack can say, I challenge this person's right to vote. And as soon as that gets said, even if there's no evidence, that voter has to be given what's called a provisional ballot. In other words, they're not allowed to just go and vote and their vote immediately gets recorded. Instead, they're given a provisional ballot, which means that later, after the election's all over, after the first returns have come in for the evening, maybe a few days later, maybe a week later, somebody's going to sit down, some bureaucrat somewhere is going to sit down, and they're going to take those provisional ballots, and one by one, they're going to go back and check and make sure that those people really are not felons, really are really live where they say they live, really are registered to vote. And if they are, then they will add them into the total. Now, there's two consequences of this challenge. Now, first of all, in 16 years, nobody has ever made a voter challenge in Florida. As far as we can tell, according to the BBC Newsnight program, they interviewed one of the election supervisors in Florida, one of the county supervisors. He says, in 16 years, nobody's ever done this because it would just bring everything to a screeching halt. But that may well be, according to the BBC Newsnight program last night, exactly what the Republicans have in mind in Florida, in the black, largely black districts, largely African-American districts, and in some other districts that are largely Democratic. This is mind-boggling. This list, this hit list, this caging list, this has names and addresses of voters in predominantly black and traditionally Democratic areas of Jacksonville, Florida. They only got this one little list, this one list about Jacksonville. God only knows how many other lists there are. This one somehow got leaked, and the BBC got a hold of it. An election supervisor in Tallahassee, when shown the list, I'm reading now from the BBC story, when new Florida vote scandal feared, an election supervisor in Tallahassee, when shown the list, told Newsnight, quote, the only possible reason why they would keep such a thing is to challenge voters on election day, end quote. They go on to say, Republican state campaign spokeswoman Mindy Tucker Fletcher stated the list was not put together in order to create a challenge list, but refused to say it would not be used in that manner. Rather, she did acknowledge that the party's poll workers will be instructed to challenge voters, quote, where it's stated in the law. End quote. In other words, they have a legal right to do it. They're going to do it. In Jacksonville, again, reading here from this BBC story, you can find it on bbc.co.uk. It's from last night's Newsnight program. In Jacksonville, to determine, it's by Greg Palast. In Jacksonville, to determine if Republicans were using the lists or other means of intimidating voters, we filmed a private detective filming early voter. Filming every early voter, the majority of whom were black, from behind a vehicle with blacked-out windows. The private detective claimed not to know who was paying for his all-day services. Yeah. He also believes in the Easter Bunny, and the Great Pumpkin is coming next week. Mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. Lots and lots of interesting things here in today's news. That among them. I just, you know, share that with you, lay it out. I'm telling you, if you read the article in this month's Atlantic Monthly about Karl Rove and how in the Alabama Supreme Court election that he managed some 6, 8, 10 years ago, whenever it was, he tied up this thing for over a year in litigation because his candidate lost. And all the time that it was in litigation, he engaged in an aggressive public relations campaign asserting that the guy who had actually won the race was a sore loser and was trying to steal the race using the courts, while Rove himself was instituting lawsuits to steal the race using the courts, which he ultimately did. It's the exact same strategy that happened in 2000. To this day, you will hear cons on you know, right-wing talk radio saying, well, you know, Al Gore had to sue bloody. It was Bush v. Gore in the Supreme Court. George W. Bush sued Al Gore. The lawsuits were initiated by the Bush side, not the Gore side. The Gore side was simply saying, count every vote, and the Bush side said, no, we've got to stop that. And while Catherine Harris certified that it was 537 more votes for George Bush than there were for Al Gore, when the newspapers looked at it, published a week after 9/11, buried in the 16th paragraph in the New York Times article, turned out there were actually, if you did a statewide recount, no matter how you recounted it, under any circumstances, Al Gore got more votes than George Bush. Well, yes, that's ancient history. No, I'm not being a sore loser. We're being sore winners, actually. But the point is, this. I am predicting this is what we're going to see again. We are going to see Karl Rove doing his thing, using the courts, if this race is at all close, which means the only option for Democrats is to make sure, or the most viable option, is to make sure that it ain't even close. And the Republicans, to make sure that it is close, of course, are engaged in voter suppression efforts. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
For more than 27 years, the progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
A must read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channels?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a four-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month per second in each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's becoming more precarious.
for failing to toe the line in what I believe in. Sounds like freedom to me.
Yes, indeed. Sounds like freedom to me. Could be freedom coming back to the United States, as those who say, no, free speech zones, loyalty oaths, national identity cards are perhaps moved out of the way, out of office. Wouldn't that be nice on November 2nd? You, too, can play a role in it. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, our website. If you'd like to drop into the chat room, click the live chat button. And we have now Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, usually calling in the second hour of our program, but it's great to hear from you in the first hour of the program, Victoria. What's up?
Well, you know, here in D.C., everybody's agog about the 380 tons of missing explosives.
Yeah.
In fact, Senator Joe Biden will be having a conference call a little bit later on today about this that we'll be joining in on, and we hope to ask some questions. He, of course, is going to express Democratic outrage about it.
You know, Joe Biden has got to be one of the most brilliant people in the United
Isn't
States
he?
Senate. Yeah, I mean, he's just amazing. He's
what a pity he messed up with the plagiarism, because he could have run for president.
Yeah. Yeah, he did run for president.
He did, but I mean, again.
12 years ago, yeah. He's really good. Anyhow, okay, so there's that.
There's that. That's really the main story. The story about Chief Justice Rehnquist is still of interest to people, particularly in light of this Ron Suskin story in the New York Times magazine. That's it was about an 8,000-page story, I think, and well into it, he talks about President Bush attending a private luncheon or dinner back in September for major funders, you know, major donors,
right,
in which he said candidly and off the record that shortly after he's elected, he expects to nominate a Supreme Court justice, the first of four.
Yeah. What
now,
what
you know,
did he know?
This, of course, before any of us knew that Rehnquist was ill.
Yeah. But, you know, Rehnquist, I mean, his daughter works as a Republican operative. This shouldn't be a surprise, I would guess. By the way,
no.
we have Ellen Ratner just phoned in, too. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm sitting here in North Dakota, which is on the border of North Dakota and Minnesota, Minnesota being a swing state. It's Fargo-Moorhead, the Twin Cities, and also I'll be going to South Dakota. I'm actually sitting, although I've talked to many swing voters, I am sitting at a table of Bush supporters right now.
Oh, my. Well, you have my sympathies.
I know.
good luck making it out intact.
Very, very scary. It's interesting out here, Tom, because, of course, one man I talked to said that he works for the post office. The postal union is very pro-carry, but his wife's a preacher for the Lutherans, the Missouri Synod, and essentially... he, you know, wants to go with the morality of Bush, but he is debating that because he's not sure he is scared of his union. And that is sort of where some of the divide is out here.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Well, I was going to say, isn't it weird that John Kerry, who has never had a scandal in his life, who is, you know, an altar boy, a good Catholic, has always lived a moral and upright life, has supported, however you define morality, I mean, has supported moral values by and large throughout his congressional career. And then you got George Bush, who's got drunken driving arrests, probable cocaine arrests, insider trading deals, you know, all his skitzy stuff on his record, and he's portrayed as the candidate of morality. It's amazing.
How they were able to pull this one off is amazing to me. The other race that's very interesting here is, of course, the Thune-Daschle race.
Yeah.
And a lot of people believe in South Dakota that this is the turnout is going to totally depend on the Native American vote.
Interesting.
And there are essentially nine chiefs have gone behind Daschle here, but Thune is saying that he's trying to do stuff for the Native American population, and everybody believes that that's what this race is going to hinge on.
That's remarkable. Well, Victoria Jones and Ellen Ratner, thank you so much for your reports, respectively, from South Dakota and Washington, D.C. today. Great to hear from you both with the Talk Radio News Service.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a great one, and we will talk with you both tomorrow. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour, the place where smart people get their news.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Talk about unsanitary. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums or wear a dust mask. Imagine vacuuming your house wearing a dust mask? Friends, try my hypoallergenic 8-pound Orrick XL free for 30 days. It's 99.99% dust-free. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions, including a 10% pay cut, in an effort to help the airline deal with its financial problems. ATA is the 10th largest airline in the U.S. It has sold some of its operations at Chicago Midway and New York's LaGuardia airports to AirTran Holdings for $87.6 million. ATA says there will be minimal impact on passengers while ATA reorganizes its business. The layoff of 156 workers was announced by the airline last Thursday. United Airlines is shifting 650 telephone reservation jobs to India. Earlier this year, United outsourced 200 call center jobs to Nova Scotia and is planning to outsource more jobs at its Denver call center.
Norwegian oil workers who have been on strike for close to 4 months are back to work today. Members of the Federation of Oil Workers Union went on strike in July against the Norwegian Shipowners Association seeking job security. More than 200 workers began the strike, barely impacting the production of the world's third largest oil exporter. Unwilling to negotiate, the association locked down more than 200 other employees out of retribution. The union replied with close to 200 more workers striking on a major oil platform. The Norwegian government, who had the power to step in and force arbitration, chose to let the two sides duke it out on their own. However, when the association threatened to extend the lockout to more than 94 oil and gas service vessels by November 8th, the government was forced to step in. Workers returned to work today, preventing further possible cutbacks in the country's oil production. Stakes have been raised at two of Atlantic City's casinos currently involved in a strike, saying they will begin hiring replacement workers to fill positions. Seeking better wage and benefit terms, as well as a three-year contract, more than 10,000 workers, represented by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, walked off the job October 1st. Both sides say that talks are ongoing, but two of the four hotels currently on strike, Harrah's and Caesars, have started running ads in local papers seeking workers. David Strau, a spokesman for Harrah's, says the hotel has no choice. Dee Taylor, the Unite Here executive president of gaming, calls the move nuclear war, and says it will just prolong the strike. Harrah's ad says that the hotel is seeking permanent replacement workers.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. The AFL-CIO says job outsourcing is accelerating. Some 406,000 jobs will be exported to cheap overseas labor markets in 2004. That compares with 204,000 3 years ago. Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Washington have all been hit hard by jobs loss. Ohio has lost nearly one in six of its manufacturing jobs. Since 2001, America has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs and 850,000 professional service and information sector jobs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Criticize. We just cannot find those guys that you say serve with you.
We can't find those guys you say served with you. Yeah. Yes, the paragon of morality who paid for an abortion for his girlfriend back when they were illegal, who didn't show up for military service. I don't get it. How can George W. Bush be the candidate of morality? It just boggles my mind. But perhaps more significant or more important or more of greater consequence, you will recall that back in the spring, the late winter, early spring of 2003, around the world were the largest, well, through the winter of 2003, the end of 2002, early 2003, were the largest demonstrations that the planet had ever seen. I mean, when Hitler invaded Poland, there were demonstrations around Europe. That was nothing compared to this. The largest protests in the history of the United States. More people turned out than turned out during the civil rights movement, than turned out during the anti-Vietnam War movement, and more people in other countries all around the world going out on the streets and saying, "Please, George, if you invade Iraq, you are going to be playing right into bin Laden's hands. You're going to be giving Osama bin Laden exactly what he wants. You're going to elevate him to sainthood status. You're going to create a recruiting poster for al-Qaeda. You're going to worsen the world problem of terrorism. Plus, you're going to be giving Iran the best Christmas gift they could ever ask for, because you're going to end up with an insurgency, ultimately probably a civil war. And I'm telling you, the civil war has already started. It's just nobody's admitting it. In Iraq, that ultimately is going to be won by the majority, as civil wars tend to be, particularly well-armed majorities with neighboring nations who share their ethnicity or their religion or their political perspective. In this case, the Shias. 90% of Iran is Shia, 60% of Iraq is Shia. How do you think Iraq is going to go if you take out Saddam Hussein, the secular guy who had been holding the religious zealots at bay? Yeah, he was a nasty guy. He was absolutely a nasty guy. And women didn't have to wear the veil, and people weren't getting whipped in the streets for serving alcohol. And the morality police, like they have in Saudi Arabia, didn't go around, and if you weren't at prayer five times a day, beat you publicly. Anyhow, during that time, you will recall the Bush administration was saying, "Oh, no, we're not sure if we're going to go to war in Iraq. We don't know if we're going to go to war in Iraq. We'll go to the UN. We'll work this out with you." You'll recall George W. Bush one time. He was asked by a reporter in late 2002. "You know, we understand that you have plans for war." This was 3-4 months out. "We understand you have plans for war." And Bush replied,
"He said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you."
Yeah. Well, today in The Independent, this story, this came out of a trial in England for Lance Corporal Ian Blamire from Leeds, who's charged with manslaughter of a comrade while serving in Iraq. He allegedly killed Sergeant John Nightingale, 32, a reservist from Ginsley, West Yorkshire, in the chest, shot him. And he's been court-martialed. And as part of his defense, he's saying that this was really a friendly fire incident, that it was essentially an accident, and that it was the result of poor training because they were deployed into Iraq without advance warning. In other words, the troops were not prepared for the kind of combat that they were going to see in Iraq, and in the course of discovery for this trial, in the course of going through the documents, of finding out what's what, a little bit of evidence came into the courtroom yesterday. Again, I mean, this is, you know, like we opened the program here with the BBC Newsnight talking about they've discovered this caging list in Florida where the Republicans are going to be challenging African Americans in Florida to vote, and trying to crash the black and the traditionally Democratic vote in the black and Jewish parts of South Florida, well, even Central Florida. But and you're not hearing that about that in the United States. I suspect you're not going to hear much about this in the United States, so I feel an obligation to report it to you. In this trial, it came out that the United States had suggested to Great Britain in December of 2002. Now, you will recall, this was long before George W. Bush said,
"He said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you."
Long before George Bush said that, the government of the United States 5 months before the invasion was launched, had passed along to the British Army chiefs their plan for the invasion of Iraq. Now, this kid in his, you know, in the court hearings, he's saying that the Army should have started training him then. And instead, the Army didn't start training until December of 2002. Now, this was still 3 months before the invasion. It was still when everybody was saying, well, we don't know. It's all going to depend on what Saddam says and what he does. When Lieutenant Colonel Warren, Lieutenant Christopher Warren, the staff officer at Land Command in Salisbury, Wiltshire, the guy who was responsible for training the troops, was asked why it was that back in October they were told that there was going to be an invasion of Iraq. They didn't start training for it until December of 2002. Now, they were told about this before the U.S. elections. Keep in mind, this was, you know, the October surprise of the 2002 elections that flipped the Congress, well, that held the Congress in Republican hands and flipped the Senate into Republican hands, was this declaration of support for George W. Bush so that he could have the stick of using force in order to go to the U.N. Turns out that about that same time that Kerry and others were voting on this thing in good conscience, in good faith, thinking that they were actually voting to give the president the power to have a threat, a legitimate threat, so that the United Nations would have more power. In other words, they were using the power, the threat of force in the United States, to help empower the United Nations. That's what they thought. At that same time, the Bush administration was telling the Blair administration, we're going in. And the Blair administration told its senior commanders this. They told this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Warren, the guy who was in charge of training, operational training, in Salisbury, Wiltshire, staff officer at Land Command, they told him, hey, we're going in. And Lieutenant Colonel Warren made the decision at that time not to begin training British troops for operations in Iraq until December. Now, in December, you'll recall, we didn't go in until March, April. In December, we were still claiming...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that.
Yeah, we were still claiming that. But they had started training their troops. And when asked why the BBC asked him, why is it that you didn't start training the troops back in October when you were told by the United States that they were going to attack Iraq? Why did you wait until December? And for that matter, why in December when you started training the troops didn't you tell, you know, Parliament that this was going on? That Tony Blair had this secret deal with George W. Bush? He says, and I quote, because in December... there was a world interest. If the UK had mobilized while all this was going on, that would have shown an intent before the political process had been allowed to run its course. End quote. You get this? We were lied to. The Brits were lied to by Tony Blair. We were lied to by George W. Bush back in 2002 when he was saying...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that.
When he was saying that over and over and over again in various ways, and his administration kept saying, they're going on all these TV shows, well, maybe we will, maybe we won't, we don't know. And already, the deal had been struck. In fact, as you know, many suggest, including Bush's former Commerce Secretary, suggest that when they came into office, the day, you know, in January of 2001... when the Bush administration came into office, they were already planning to take out Saddam. And many suggest that it goes back to the Project for New American Century's letter to Bill Clinton in 1998, signed by Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, who in 1998 everybody expected would become the Republican nominee for president. They didn't reckon Karl Rove. Jeb Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Donald Rumsfeld, in 1998, signing a letter to Bill Clinton, saying, you must attack Iraq now. And why did they do this? Well, the various people had various motives, but broadly it seems that these guys were believing Ahmed Chalabi of the Iranian National Congress that we were paying $340,000 a month to. We were paying this guy, the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, was paying this guy $340,000 a month. How'd you like to have that as a salary? And in exchange for that, this guy was telling them, the Iraqi people, you know, they will welcome you with flowers, everything will be fine, I'll step into the vacuum, we'll take over. And it turns out that Chalabi was funneling intelligence from these guys, Wolfowitz, Pearl, back to the Iranians, the Axis of Evil Iranians, and that he was just setting this whole thing up, apparently, for Iran. We were suckered by Iran. And now, you know, here, today's New York Times, no check of bunker unit commander says, again, yeah, I mean, where did these 370, 380 tons of powerful explosives end up? Maybe in Iran, who knows? White House officials reasserted yesterday, this is an article by Jim Dwyer and David Sanger, that 380 tons of powerful explosives may have disappeared from a vast Iraqi military complex while Saddam Hussein controlled Iraq. So this is the Republican talking point, right? Saddam did it. Not our fault. It's never the Republicans' fault. Never, ever. Not once in 4 years has anything been their fault. But the unit's commander said in an interview yesterday that his troops had not searched the site and had merely stopped there overnight. The commander, Colonel Joseph Anderson of the 2nd Brigade of the Army's 101st Airborne Division, said he did not learn until this week that the site, Al-Qaqa, was considered sensitive or that international inspectors had visited it before the war began in 2003 to inspect explosives that they had tagged during the decade of monitoring. In this article in the New York Times, Colonel Anderson, who is now the chief of staff for the division and who spoke by telephone from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, said his troops had been driving north toward Baghdad and had paused at Al-Qaqa to make plans for the next push. He said, quote, "We happened to stumble on it. I didn't know what the place was supposed to be. We did not get involved in any of the bunkers. It was not our mission. It was not our focus. We were just stopping there on our way to Baghdad. The plan was to leave that very same day. The plan was not to go in there and start searching. It looked like all the other ammunition supply points we had already seen." End quote. Of course, my guess is the right-wingers, the hysterical right-wingers, are going to continue trying to peddle this lie. Time will tell. Let's take a few calls. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And let's see, we'll start with Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, to paraphrase the saying from Love Story, I guess, being a Republican means you never have to say you're sorry.
Yeah, it apparently is true, and it's unfortunate because it's not historically a Republican value. Historically, you know, the Republicans, I disagree with the historic Republican perspective, but I also have a lot of respect for the particularly the early historic, you know, from the 1840s when the party was first formed, late 1850s rather, right up through the 1870s, you know, when the populists and progressives split off. The Republican Party was the party of reform.
It was.
And then Teddy Roosevelt, you know, 1906, instituting the estate tax and aggressively saying, you know, great wealth is a corrupter of democracy. And in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt passing laws that, you know, the Republican Teddy Roosevelt passing laws that it was a felony for a corporation to participate in politics.
Well, I think it goes later than that. I think it goes right up to Eisenhower. And then when Goldwater came in, that's what kind of changed things. But getting to the topic at hand, this business about the missing weapons. Now, I haven't followed it too closely, but what's amazing to me, and I guess I shouldn't be amazed, is how quickly the Republican spin machine, the Limbaughs, the Ann Coulters, the O'Reillys are out there, you know, saying, well, this was done way before we invaded. It's not Bush's fault. And, yeah. And you know, even a local talk show here in Grand Rapids, which kind of leans to the right, they were talking about the story today. A caller calls in and says, well, why are you guys even talking about this? Rush already took care of this story. And, you know, the blind loyalty that these people show to certain right-wing talk show hosts who, you said about Bush, have a lot of skeletons in their closet. I guess what really scares me is, and I don't want to knock the Christians because I'm one myself, but the right-wing Christians are so easily led. You know, Jesse Ventura was actually right. Whatever anybody on the right says, especially if they claim to be a Christian, no matter what their personal life is like, they just eat it up and they vote Republican. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, Rick, and I think that these people are more cultists than Christians. Let's go to Dave from Columbus, Ohio, and thanks for the call, Rick, by the way. Dave, welcome to the program. We've got about a minute here.
Hey, Tom, good day to you. I just wanted to challenge a couple of your assertions. First of all, in the earlier segment, you said that the New York Times had concluded that Al Gore won the election, and that's not true. I would like to see the report that you saw on that.
Sure. It was in the New York Times, Dave. Dave, I'm going to ask you to hold over the break here. If you want to challenge me, I love it. But we got to take a break. It's 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the real free speech zone. Stick around. I'll be right back.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research is responsible for the following message. It was not approved by any candidate nor by any candidate's committee.
Hello, my name is Cindy, and I am a progressive. For many years, I've supported Ralph Nader, always admiring his many accomplishments. However, at this critical time, I cannot support his candidacy. You see, I have Parkinson's disease, and embryonic stem cell research may one day save my life. George W. Bush has severely restricted funding for stem cell research. He also threatens to jail doctors and scientists who want to use nuclear transfer research to cure debilitating diseases. On the other hand, John Kerry vows to remove President Bush's restrictions and to openly fund this vital research. Ralph Nader recently admitted that he has no chance to win this presidential election. A vote for Nader can only be a vote for Bush. Please don't throw your vote away. My life depends on it. Thank you.
A university taps the deep waters of a nearby lake to keep its campus cool. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Cornell University is a major research institution that's located near Cayuga Lake, one of the Finger Lakes in upstate New York. Cornell uses a lot of energy for air conditioning during the summer, and a few engineers found a creative way to use Cayuga Lake to cool off the campus. Lanny Joyce is an engineer at Cornell's Utilities Department, and he helped develop the university's Lake Source Cooling Project. He says Cayuga Lake is so deep that only part of it warms up in the summer. Joyce says there's a layer of frigid water at the bottom of the lake all year long, and the university is using it to cool pipes that provide air conditioning to the campus.
We're saving 87% of the electricity of doing cooling the conventional way, which makes an annual electric use reduction in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 million a year. So it's a significant savings in electricity use and something that's a huge benefit to the global environment by not having to generate that electricity in some regional power plant.
The university performed environmental assessments before and after pipes were laid for the cooling system. Some people worried that the lake might warm up because the water that comes back from campus is warmer than when it was pumped out. Joyce says that's not an issue.
The amount of heat turns out in reality to be the equivalent of about 2 hours of additional sunlight over the course of a year.
Cornell's system went into operation 4 years ago. The city of Toronto recently built a modified version of the Cornell system, and it's now using water from the depths of Lake Ontario to cool 100 office buildings downtown. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We're just living our American dream. The CEOs are playing for the Bush Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware.
Step out or stretch hummers and everybody stands. Parents, blockers, get daughters. Here comes the billionaire.
And welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you. 5 minutes before the hour, 4.5 minutes or so before the hour. And we were talking to Dave in Columbus, Ohio. Dave, you want to start your rant again?
Thanks. Love that intro. Hey, the assertion you made about George Bush not having won Florida there, the article, every quote I've heard about that particular article you're talking about says that in no recount did Al Gore win the vote in there. And I would like to see what you're reading that says differently. I mean, I'm willing to look at it, but I would think that with the New York Times being so anti-George Bush, that would have been above the fold in bold letters, and we would have heard about it.
Well,
a month.
The problem was, and the reason why, and the New York Times, Hal Raines actually talked about this in an interview a little later, was because 9/11 had just happened. We're talking in an article called "Examining the Vote: The Overview: Study of Disputed Florida Ballots Find Justices Did Not Cast the Deciding Vote," published on November 12, 2001, the day after 9/11. And if you go down to, I'm looking at the third page of a printout here. The consortium asked, where does it go? The consortium asked all 67 counties what standards, where did it go? The court ultimately, I didn't have it right here in front of me.
Can you link it on your website there?
Well, the problem is, you know, it's now you've got to buy it, you know, from the New York Times because it's in. But the what they say is that the different standards. If all the ballots had been reviewed under any of seven single standards and combined with the results of an examination of overvotes, Mr. Gore would have won by a very narrow margin. For example, using the most permissive, you know, they go through that whole thing, using the most restrictive standard, but all the other. But there was the. See, it's buried in here, and so, I will. I promise you, I will find it in the next hour. I will read it to you out loud on the air.
I'm listening to you on Sirius. We don't catch you.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, basically the bottom line is what they say is that if every single vote in Florida was counted, which was not what Al Gore was asking for, if every single vote in Florida had been counted, Gore would have won by any standard. And it's in this article. I guarantee it's in this article. November 12, 2001. You can buy it for $3 in the New York Times. You know, like I said, I'll read it on the air in the next hour. Or we can come back to it tomorrow if you want to give me a call. Dave, thanks for the call. I got to go. But, you know, it's a good start. An interesting conversation. It's and it's unfortunate. You know, Hal Raines going on later on and saying, well, yeah, you know. And Al Gore knows this, and the Democrats in Florida know this. And it's funny because I've heard cons say, well, no matter how you calculated it, Gore, you know, lost any of the scenarios. No, if you counted every vote in the state, and they actually did, Gore won. But as I said, it's ancient history.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Music.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions, including a 10% pay cut, in an effort to help the airline deal with its financial problems. ATA is the 10th largest airline in the U.S. It has sold some of its operations at Chicago Midway and New York's LaGuardia airports to AirTran Holdings for $87.6 million. ATA says there will be minimal impact on passengers while ATA reorganizes its business. A layoff of 156 workers was announced by the airline last Thursday. United Airlines is shifting 650 telephone reservation jobs to India. Earlier this year, United outsourced 200 call center jobs to Nova Scotia and is planning to outsource more jobs at its Denver call center.
Norwegian oil workers who have been on strike for close to 4 months are back to work today. Members of the Federation of Oil Workers Union went on strike in July against the Norwegian Shipowners Association seeking job security. More than 200 workers began the strike, barely impacting the production of the world's third largest oil exporter. Unwilling to negotiate, the association locked down more than 200 other employees out of retribution. The union replied with close to 200 more workers striking on a major oil platform. The Norwegian government, who had the power to step in and force arbitration, chose to let the two sides duke it out on their own. However, when the association threatened to extend the lockout to more than 94 oil and gas service vessels by November 8th, the government was forced to step in. Workers returned to work today, preventing further possible cutbacks in the country's oil production. Stakes have been raised at two of Atlantic City's casinos currently involved in a strike, saying they will begin hiring replacement workers to fill positions. Seeking better wage and benefit terms, as well as a three-year contract, more than 10,000 workers, represented by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, walked off the job October 1st. Both sides say that talks are ongoing, but two of the four hotels currently on strike, Harrah's and Caesars, have started running ads in local papers seeking workers. David Strau, a spokesman for Harrah's, says the hotel has no choice. Dee Taylor, the Unite Here executive president of gaming, calls the move nuclear war and says it will just prolong the strike. Harrah's ad says that the hotel is seeking permanent replacement workers.
Here's today's DalBob report. The AFL-CIO says job outsourcing is accelerating. Some 406,000 jobs will be exported to cheap overseas labor markets in 2004. That compares with 204,000 3 years ago. Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Washington have all been hit hard by jobs loss. Ohio has lost nearly 1 in 6 of its manufacturing jobs. Since 2001, America has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs and 850,000 professional service and information sector jobs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I had survived two previous rounds of layoffs, and then the third round got me. They wiped out my whole department. I was forced to stop paying credit card payments. I had to file bankruptcy. I had to be rushed to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy, for which I'm not insured. How can we be the only westernized country without national health care? I can't believe that this is the best we can do. There's got to be a better way. I'm voting for John Kerry.
Move On PAC is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Am I the only one who wants to say to Donald Trump, please, Donnie, please take your orange-dyed, bad comb-over hairdo and your grotesquely inflated ego and go away? The Donald, as he likes to be known, is the self-promoting high society celebrity who vamps shamelessly as a hard-nosed CEO on the reality TV show called The Apprentice. He also has a book out called Trump, How to Get Rich. In both the show and the book, Donnie poses as a very rich, successful businessman. He is rich, but he didn't get there himself. Instead, he got rich the old-fashioned way. He inherited a New York City real estate fortune from his daddy. And as for being a business success, you might want to ask investors in his struggling casino empire about that. Trump Hotels and Casino Resorts is the one business venture that he launched on his own, his claim to corporate success. It's crumbling. Worse, it's about to crash. Only 2 weeks after signing a new contract with NBC to pose as a business mogul on The Apprentice for another season, his Real Life Corporation announced a quarterly loss of $49 million. Indeed, Trump Hotels has never been profitable in its decade-long history, and it is stuck so deeply in some $2 billion of debt that Trump's own auditors say there is substantial doubt about whether it can survive. Donnie says it's not his fault. This has nothing to do with me, he whined. Yoo-hoo, you're Trumpness. You're the CEO and chairman of the board. Investors and analysts lay the blame squarely at the Donald's feet, accusing him of ineffective management, slipshod financial practices, and a lack of competitive business vision. From his own board members and creditors, the CEO is about to hear the trademark phrase he uses on his TV show, "You're fired." This is Jim Hightower saying, it couldn't happen to a more deserving guy. What a fraud.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me. You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. Score power at Equifax.com.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Dave in Columbus, Ohio, in the last hour raised this question. I have to close this out before we move along to the guest that we have this hour for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. And he had challenged my comment, which I had opened the show with, almost parenthetically. I mean, I point this out from time to time, that if all the votes in Florida had been counted in the year 2000, I realize this is ancient history, but let's just set the record straight. If all the votes had been counted, according to this consortium of newspapers, including the New York Times, then Al Gore would have won the state of Florida, period. The media consortium included the Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Tribune Company, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, the St. Petersburg Times, the Palm Beach Post, and CNN. And reading now from the November 12, 2001, this was the day after 9/11, article in the New York Times, in which they sought to downplay this because they were concerned that it would harm George W. Bush's legitimacy when he was dealing with the national crisis of 9/11, as Hal Raines later told a reporter. Let me just read to you a few sentences from the article. The consortium, looking at a broader group of rejected ballots than those covered in the court decisions, 175,010 in all, found that Mr. Gore might have won if the courts had ordered a full statewide recount on all rejected ballots. The findings indicate that Mr. Gore might have eked out a victory if he had pursued in court a case like the one he publicly advocated when he called on the state to count all the votes. And then they go on to say what that means. Under some methods, Mr. Gore would have emerged the winner, and they go on through this. Even so, the media ballot review carried out under the most rigorous rules, far removed from the chaos and partisan heat of the post-election dispute, is unlikely to end the argument, they point out. And then they say the numbers reveal the flaws in Gore's post-election tactics. And here's the buried lead. and approached Mr. Gore, and his lawyers rejected it as impractical. A statewide recount would have produced enough votes to tilt the election his way, no matter what standard was chosen to judge voter intent. And then they go through the breakout. If the statewide count was done, which they did, the newspapers did, Gore would have received the most votes by any measure. If only allowing punch card ballots and correctly marked optical scan ballots, he would have won by 115 votes. Using each county's own standard, would have won by 171 counties. Also allowing dimples on punch cards or any marks on optical scan ballots that indicated a candidate's choice, he would have won by 107 votes. So by any standard, if the entire state had been counted, there it is, New York Times, September 12th, 2001. But as I said, that's ancient history. It just makes me crazy when I hear cons say, well, you know, Bush did win Florida fair and square. I mean, this is even setting aside the absolute, you know, the disenfranchisement of tens of thousands of African Americans. But that's not the topic for this hour. You know, sometimes there are things that you think you know what you know, and this might have been one of them. Other times, maybe you don't know what you didn't know, or you don't know what you do know. You know, sometimes maybe even everything you know is wrong. Usually on Thursday afternoons we get into this, but seeing as how yesterday was the anniversary of Paul Wellstone's death, today we're going to do our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be James Fetzer, the McKnight professor at the University of Minnesota, is the author of a book on the topic which covers Senator Paul Wellstone's death. Mr. Fetzer, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Actually, co-author with Don Four Arrows Jacobs, whom
yes.
I'm sure you've had on your show before.
Yeah, and who I know. Should I call you Professor Fetzer, Dr.
Jim.
Fetzer? Jim. Okay, Jim. That's great.
Let me think, Tom. I think the remarks you were making just now carry right into today. There's a piece in the Washington Post about the GOP's shameful vote strategy by Harold Meyerson, who that begins, "With Election Day almost upon us, it's not clear whether President Bush is running a campaign or plotting a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
By all accounts, Republicans are spending these last precious days devoting nearly as much energy to suppressing the Democratic vote as they are to mobilizing their own."
Oh, yeah, and it's what they did last time, and we wouldn't have known about it if Florida hadn't been so close. I mean,
absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and this probably happened in numerous states last time, and we simply never knew about it because they weren't close, so they didn't get the scrutiny. This time, they're going to get the scrutiny, and it looks like it's going to happen anyway. I mean, I'd like to talk to you about Paul Wellstone in this book.
Of course.
Unfortunately, in the PR piece I have here, and we put this thing together fairly quickly, and so I don't have a copy of the book, and I don't have the title of the book. Can you tell us what the title is?
Yeah, sure. The title is American Assassination, The Strange Death of Senator Paul Wellstone. And
okay.
The book has just been released. You can get information about the book from a public issues website I maintain at assassinationscience.com. You'll find a description and introduction to the book, pre-publication blurbs, even the first review that has appeared about it, or on Amazon.com.
Right. Okay. So the title again is?
As American Assassination.
Okay. Great. And how did you first get into this? What made you think?
Well, I'm, of course, from Minnesota. I teach at the University of Minnesota on the Duluth campus. And the day of the crash, as you observed two years ago yesterday, I was being interviewed in my office by a reporter for a local alternative newspaper called The Ripsaw about JFK. I've spent the last decade plus working with the most highly qualified individuals to ever study that case. We have taken it back to the most basic evidence, the autopsy x-rays, the autopsy report, the photographs and all that, and worked from the ground up, sorting the real evidence, the authentic evidence from the inauthentic, Tom. And when you do that, you discover that the case actually is very straightforward, but we found the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head in one case, in another adding a 6.5-millimeter metallic slice.
Yeah, but that's another show. I mean, I'm with you on that, and in fact, you'll find Anthony Summers crediting me in the back of his new edition of Conspiracy,
for
research
point
on the JFK.
That all these techniques that were used in JFK sensitize you, make you aware of the ways in which the government can deceive and manipulate and mislead the American people.
Right. So you're suggesting that Senator Paul Wellstone was actually murdered.
Yes.
Assassinated.
And it was for political reasons. That's right.
And
the Just an interesting point to begin, Tom, and then we can go or not go
well,
any further.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes here with
the comparison line. But you see, with JFK, they spirited the body out of Dallas to get it under medical military control.
Under
so
federal
control,
yeah.
You know, conceal what actually had happened to him. In the case of Wellstone, the body burned for hours and hours. This plane burned for like 5 hours after the crash. And they could only identify the victims from dental records.
Yeah.
Plus the Lincoln limousine JFK was riding was taken back to Ford Motor Company Monday, the day of the formal state funeral, and completely rebuilt. I mean, that's a crime scene on wheels.
Yeah.
Now, in this case with Wellstone, the plane was so thoroughly burned, the fuselage, not the wings, which is ironic because the wings are the part that's loaded with fuel.
Yeah.
It burned so thoroughly that, you know, evidence of potential evidence of crimes was completely destroyed by the
Now, Jim, a couple of things that have popped up in my mind over the years, and I'd like you to just, you know, tell me if I'm crazy or not. First of all, I'm a pilot. I'm a private pilot. Back in 1972, I got my private pilot's license. I haven't flown in 8 or 10 years at least. I'm not current, but I'm legal. And when I was learning to fly, my flight instructor had this little trick that he would play on me when I was doing instrument flight rules, when we were doing, IFR flying, where you're flying just on the instruments. You're wearing a hood. We do it on clear days, so it was relatively safe. We'd go up to 5,000-6,000 feet, put on a hood so you can only see the, like a welding hood that's kind of tipped up so you can only see the instrument panel. And without my knowing it, he would slip a little kitchen refrigerator magnet up underneath the console and just, attach it to the side of the magnetic compass. And what it would do was spin the compass off 3 or 4 degrees to one side. And so my magnetic compass was disagreeing with some of my other instruments. And it always screwed me up. He would get me, right? And when Mel Carnahan's plane went down and he died, and that, of course, he was running against John Ashcroft, and John Ashcroft, I'm assuming, he died just a couple weeks before the election, and Ashcroft,
right.
I'm assuming, figured that he would win. He had no idea that the people of Missouri would vote for a dead guy over him. And then when Paul Wellstone went down, in a similar circumstance, in both cases, these planes were coming in on IFR approaches, instrument flight rules approaches. They were in the clouds. They couldn't see the ground, and in both cases, they missed the runway in that horizontal fashion that I used to encounter when my flight instructor would stick one of those kitchen magnets up underneath the dash of the plane. Do you think am I off base here? Could it have been something that simple?
Well, when you ask could it have been, I mean, there are different kinds of possibility. There's nothing inconsistent about your description that makes it logically impossible, and there's nothing about the laws of nature that makes it physically impossible, but it doesn't comport with the evidence we have in this case.
Okay, so what do you think happened?
Well, see, the NTSB, coming in there, it was a very conventional, landing. Everything seemed perfectly normal until about 10:18, 10:19. The plane was flying from Minneapolis. It had taken off about 9:30. It was doing about 10:20. And something happened as it was coming in on the approach. They'd already switched on the airport lights.
Right.
The plane crashed, burned for hours, as I've explained. But the FBI, Tom, was on the scene almost immediately. They were there by noon. Well, the airport assistant manager didn't even locate the scene of the crash until 11 o'clock by whitish blue smoke, which you may realize is an indication of an electrical fire rather than a kerosene-based fuel fire, which would burn coarsely black. So he identified the scene of the crash but didn't notify anyone, went down, picked up the fire chief, took him up about 11:15. Nevertheless, when the sheriff for St. Louis County, Rick Wahlberg, arrived on the scene at 1:30, he saw individuals from the FBI Rapid Response Team in St. Paul that he knew personally. Gary Ullman, the assistant airport manager, confirmed that the FBI had been there at least since 1:00.
Jim, let me pause you here for just a second. We've only got about 3 minutes left. I want to nail this thing down. Are you suggesting then that the FBI had some knowledge of this, or that the federal government played some role in the assassination of Paul Wellstone?
Well, there's no way they could have been there by noon without leaving at the same time the plane took off, Tom. It appears to have been the use of a high-tech weapon that took out the electronics, the navigational aid, the communication, so that you couldn't even call in for distress. The electrical system appears to have been overloaded, probably started an internal fire. We have an odd cell phone phenomena. We have some garage doors that were opening, weird things that indicate that this plane was not under the pilot's control. Even a member of the NTSB owned committee said that they were merely speculating. They had no idea what caused the plane to crash.
Jim, who did it?
Simulation. airplanes using pilots with similar background.
I believe you.
Unable to bring the plane down, Tom. They replicated the weather, the conditions of flight plan, had them fly abnormally slowly. They could not cause the plane to crash.
Yeah.
It was not due to the plane, the pilots, or the weather. Your listeners may be interested to know that NTS reports are not even admissible as evidence in courts of law. Plus, that a scene like this can only be investigated as a crime scene if the Attorney General declares it to be one. So if you have a compliant or complicit Attorney General, you got a perfect mode of cover-up. You take the plane down, then he simply declines to declare it a crime scene. The NTSB only investigates accident alternatives.
Okay, Jim, we've got about 20 seconds left. Who did this?
Well, it appears to have been motivated by the White House. The strongest suspects appear to be Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. Dick Cheney had delivered a personal warning to Paul Wellstone that if he opposed them on the war in Iraq, there'd be severe ramifications for him in the state of Minnesota.
So you think he was taken out by these guys?
Senate. He was their foremost critic. They wanted to take control of the Senate. They appear to have done so by underhanded means, taking Max Cleland out in Georgia by manipulating electronic voting.
Yeah, I got it. Jim, we got to pause. Was it there? The website for this, I'm sorry, it's just the tyranny of the clock here, but this is great information. The website is assassinationscience.com, and we're talking with Dr. James Fetzer, McKnight Professor, University of Minnesota in Duluth. A great book, American Assassination. Jim, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
20 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman program.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Bush administration can't seem to get it right when it comes to creating jobs. In the U.S., there's a net loss of jobs. In Iraq, the Bush administration blames a clerical error for overstating the number of Iraqi jobs in projects funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The agency first said more than 88,000 were working in its projects as of September 15th, but that has changed to just under 46,000 blamed on a clerical error.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace.
The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Psycho Cowboy, yippee-yi, whoopee-whoopee-tie, whoopee-whoopee-tie, don't you? Don't run, run away.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're continuing this week, throughout the week here, with the special audio clips that we've been able to acquire from the Bill O'Reilly audio file. Bill O'Reilly's online, actually they're from liegirls.com, liegirls.com. And some of these are just so great. Some would say they're a little over the top, but just have to share this with you. This is.
Howdy, cowpoke.
See, this.
I want you.
This for George W. Bush, I think.
Or alive.
Yeah.
I'm just a poor little cowgirl looking for a big, manly man to help me clear all this brush.
All this brush? Bush is always clearing brush.
Ooh, it's just so hard. There's just so much brush to clear. Landscaping is such hard, hard work. Oh, I wish Carl Rove would stop planting all this brush. Then I wouldn't have to keep clearing it all the time.
He's a real cowboy, Lie Girls. I mean, although there's no horses on his ranch because he's afraid to ride horses. He's afraid of horses, but, he's a real cowboy.
Oh.
Yeah, he really
Texans
is.
Texans are so down to earth and authentic, especially Texans who was born in Connecticut and went to prep school in Massachusetts, college in New Haven, and business school in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
When real Texans vacation in Kennebunkport, you just know they can't wait to get back to the ranch they purchased in 1999 when they was running for president.
Well, it was actually a pig farm before it was a ranch, so, it's kind of hard to say.
Did you know George W. Bush is a direct descendant of the House of King David?
Oh, no, not this.
Turn the W upside down and it stands for Messiah. Actively working to bring about peace in the Middle East sounds like a good idea, but isn't it better in the long run to do nothing, thereby hastening the apocalypse and the rapture and the second coming? Seriously, the Jews and the Muslims who survived the tribulation will thank us.
The 800 number that Bill O'Reilly calls. When he's feeling a little frisky, and apparently George W. Bush as well. 1-866-889-8894. The Tom Hartman Program here with you. That, by the way, that from Liegirls, liegirls.com. Some great satires on there that I'm going to be sharing with you as the week goes on. Hope you're not excessively offended by it, but hopefully a little bit. Hey, Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It was very interesting. Yesterday I was listening to some of the right-wing shows. I gag them down because I want to listen to everything. And they were basically coming out and saying, and I won't mention any names because I don't want to give them a plug, but there were a couple of them that were saying, they don't even mention this 370 tons of missing HMX. What they were doing was they were talking about this amazingly little tiny thing they took out of context from John Edwards' wife, where they're claiming that she is saying that they're inciting to riot in Pennsylvania, that the Democrats are going to be inciting to riot in Pennsylvania if, in fact, Kerry does not win there. Did you hear that?
I did not hear that, but you know, nothing surprises me these days. You know, yeah. And the other thing that you find, Chuck, so often is that the Karl Rove strategy. And it's so well laid out in this current issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Karl Rove's strategy has been for the last 30 years to accuse your opponent of what you intend to do before you do it, so right. that when you do it, your opponent can't accuse you of it.
Well, let me if you put me back on hold, I'll pass along because I don't want to give these guys a plug, but I want to let you know where to go to look on the web.
Yeah. Okay. Well, or if it's not, it's not urgent for today, you can just email it to me at tom@tomhartman.com.
Oh, okay.
Okay. It comes right to me. And
okay,
yes, I know the whole world just heard that. That's fine. It's on my website. Chuck in Los Alamos, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Our number 1-866-889-8894. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. You're in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire here. No, just intelligence and truth.
A must read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about the Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions, including a 10% pay cut, in an effort to help the airline deal with its financial problems. ATA is the 10th largest airline in the U.S. It has sold some of its operations at Chicago Midway and New York's LaGuardia airports to AirTran Holdings for $87.6 million. ATA says there will be minimal impact on passengers while ATA reorganizes its business. The layoff of 156 workers was announced by the airline last Thursday. United Airlines is shifting 650 telephone reservation jobs to India. Earlier this year, United outsourced 200 call center jobs to Nova Scotia and is planning to outsource more jobs at its Denver call center.
Norwegian Oil worked oil and gas service vessels by November 8th. The government was forced to step in. Workers returned to work today, preventing further possible cutbacks in the country's oil production. Stakes have been raised at two of Atlantic City's casinos currently involved in a strike, saying they will begin hiring replacement workers to fill positions. Seeking better wage and benefit terms, as well as a three-year contract, more than 10,000 workers, represented by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, walked off the job October 1st. Both sides say that talks are ongoing, but two of the four hotels currently on strike, Harrah's and Caesars, have started running ads in local papers seeking workers. David Strau, a spokesman for Harrah's, says the hotel has no choice. Dee Taylor, the Unite Here executive president of gaming, calls the move nuclear war and says it will just prolong the strike. Harrah's ad says that the hotel is seeking permanent replacement workers.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. The AFL-CIO says job outsourcing is accelerating. Some 406,000 jobs will be exported to cheap overseas labor markets in 2004. That compares with 204,000 3 years ago. Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Washington have all been hit hard by jobs loss. Ohio has lost nearly 1 in 6 of its manufacturing jobs. Since 2001, America has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs and 850,000 professional service and and information sector jobs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
4 more years of sweet compassion, conservatism feels so right. I know I'll be well cared for so long as I am rich and white.
Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-889-8894. The website tomhartman.com, however you spell it. It'll get you there. Correct spelling is T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, but however you spell it, it'll get you there, and you can drop into our live chat room if you'd like. Share time with some of the finest minds on all of the Internet, and also participate in our bulletin board. We're running our contest, What Will Be the October Surprise? Mike Toth has acquired a copy of October Surprise, the groundbreaking book by Barbara Honegger that first exposed George Bush Sr.'s participation with the Iranian government back in 1980 in holding the hostages long enough to make Jimmy Carter go down in defeat so that Reagan could become president. And that extreme collector's item book, you know, almost immediately after it came out, the publishing company was bought out and shut down, and the books were recalled. That collector copy of that book is going to be given away right after the election to whoever most accurately predicts in the thread that we have on our message board who, or what, rather, is the October surprise. What is the most successful October surprise? What's the part of, you know, it might end up that it's a Democratic October surprise. Who knows? But, you know, assuming that the Republicans are trying to pull something out of the hat here at the last minute. And they certainly have been trying to, but boy, has the news been going against them. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. John in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Man, oh man. I'll tell you what, that was a great lead-in for what I've got to say with that, especially that 1980 book you were talking about.
Yeah, it's really an amazing piece of literature. It's startling.
Yeah, right.
Barbara Honegger actually worked in the White House with Reagan and Bush,
yeah,
and the picture on the back cover is her shaking hands with the two of them. You know?
Oh, yeah. That was amazing. Just an amazing story that George Bush arranged for the Iranians to hold those guys a little bit longer to get Reagan in office. I mean, that's just perfect for what I called for. I mean, when I tuned you in today, you were talking to a guy, and I didn't catch his name, but now let me get this right. He believes, and you had this guy on your program, he believes that Rumsfeld and Cheney and Karl Rove had Mel Carnahan and Paul Wellstone killed.
Well, specifically Wellstone, yeah. And I'm not, you know, I haven't read his book. I'm not endorsing his position. Let me tell you, I appreciate your laughter, John. I really do. Every Thursday afternoon, the second hour of the program, we have this segment where we call Everything You Know Is Wrong, where we bring on conspiracy theory folks and people with strange ideas and let them have their say. And,
Wednesday.
I know. We moved it up a date because we're doing the C-SPAN thing on Friday and everything is getting
Oh, man.
You know, he may or, you know, he may be onto something. Maybe he's nuts.
I honestly don't know. Paul Wellstone killed.
Well, it did flip the Senate. So, you know, if you're conspiracy-minded, you can go for it. John, was that your point?
Yeah, pretty much. Oh, satire. The idea of satire, you know, that you had this guy on. That satire, that stuff you had on right after with O'Reilly, that wasn't particularly funny or satirical. It was kind of gross.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thanks for your opinion, John. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Paul in Florida on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
First, I'd like to comment about those electronic pulse magnetic instruments that our military easily has that capability.
You mean to bring down Paul Wellstone's plane?
Oh, God, yes.
So you're in the camp of thinking that Wellstone was murdered?
No question in my mind.
Okay, well, you know, you and John should have a conversation.
Well, why? We're both convinced, but yeah. I'd like to further elaborate on that technology.
Okay, Armin. John, go ahead. Or Paul, excuse me.
After the debates, C-SPAN put up the numbers for your candidate, Kerry, Bush, and our others. And when my wife and I and some friends in Florida here tried to call, our cell phones were blocked out. They were out of order. They wouldn't even call. Totally out of order for the carry number.
Yeah. You know, my guess is that there was just so many people calling that it got overloaded. I really think that a lot of folks, maybe it's human nature, but I think a lot of us see conspiracies where there's just coincidences. On the other hand, there are times when there are real conspiracies. I mean, you know, look at what happened in Florida in 2000. So.
We call it a conspiracy, but the people at the top that perpetrate these things call it a consensus.
Yeah. Well.
And if you don't think in your heart that they'd go to war, lie, cheat, and steal, program the American people, cover up stuff, conceal stuff illegally, unconstitutionally, so that they could get a hold of that oil, I'll tell you what. The Brooklyn Bridge is for sale. You want to buy it for $100?
Well, Paul, I think we've seen all that. What I'm not sure I believe is that they're willing to kill a United States senator.
What about 9/11? You cannot tell me that Bush didn't stand down for 9/11 because I live 4 miles from the school where he was at, and nobody's come to me yet in this area and said anything about a military overfly the day that 9/11 went down when he was sitting in that classroom.
Yeah.
That tells me he felt he was secure, and he, in my opinion, knew it was going down and the rehearsals were over, and he was trying to figure out what was his best plan of play.
Well, again, I'm not yet convinced. I'm not unconvinced, Paul. I'm not unconvinced. I think that we need to have a legitimate investigation. I think it's weird that the Bush administration, after the Columbia crashed, allocated $50 million to investigate it. But when the 9/11 investigation began, they only allocated $3 million for it, and they fought it tooth and nail until the point, you know, that it became. They couldn't fight it anymore. I mean, it was just obvious they couldn't fight it anymore. But, you know, again, I frankly, personally, don't think the Bush administration had anything to do with 9/11. I do think that they knew something big was coming. And George Bush was notified of this when he was in Texas. He had been hearing about it for some time, and he was scared to death to go back to Washington, D.C. He took the longest vacation in the history of the American presidency, and even then wouldn't go back to Washington, D.C. But maybe it's a coincidence. So spin it however you want. Take it however you want. 1-866-889-8894. Chris in Albuquerque, or Abiquiu, New Mexico. I'm getting it right this time, Chris. What's up?
I'm honored you remembered. Speaking of missing the high explosive in Iraq, really interesting back and forth on NBC this morning between Joe Biden and Saxby Chambliss, who I call Dreidel because of the way he spins. Chambliss was completely floored. I mean, he threw out the talking points, you know, that the second of the 101st had already been there and couldn't find it. And Katie Couric, of all people, gave the quote of the commander of the second of the 101st and completely floored him. And then Biden stepped in and said, look, it doesn't matter. We don't have to talk about this specific 370 tons of high explosive. Both the White House and the Pentagon acknowledge, everybody knows that there are thousands of tons of explosives and munitions and guns. He told a story about Fallujah I'd never heard. He said, you know, they started offering like $100 for every RPG that was brought in.
Right.
And these two old guys in pickup trucks came in from the desert with two pickup trucks full of RPGs.
Yeah.
And they left, and they came back 8 hours later with two more pickup trucks filled with RPGs.
Sure, it was good money.
This is
you know, I started the program with this yesterday because at the point, you know, at noon Eastern time, an NBC reporter had been embedded with the Army, and they had actually been to the ammo dump right after or just, you know, right around the time Baghdad was taken. That the weapons were gone. And so all the cons, of course, were taking that, right, it was their talking points. And I was saying, you know, we don't know yet. I'm not willing to say that that's not the case. I'm not willing to say it is the case. Let's get a little evidence here before we go flying off the handle. Larger picture. The larger issue is that we had, you know, that there was this hornet's nest there, but it was a contained hornet's nest. We knew what was there. We knew where it was. We had weapons inspectors in place. We had inspectors from the IAEA there. We had, you know, I mean, two different UN agencies. And all the evidence now of the Doffler report and previously what David Kaye said and before that what Scott Ritter had said back in 98 was that the sanctions and the inspections were actually effective in containing whatever threats Saddam may have represented. And busting that thing open not only creates a marvelous opportunity for Iran, which they are, in my opinion, they are taking advantage of right now very aggressively to create a Shiite theocracy in Iraq, which is my prediction for 1 year from today. You're going to see, you're going to have a Shiite theocracy in Iraq. And
I don't think so. I think you're going to have a civil war. The Sunnis.
Well,
are
absolutely, they are having a civil war right now. I mean, it has already begun, and it's just nobody's calling it that. And the outcome of it is going to be a Shiite theocracy, or we're going to step in, perhaps with some other countries, and impose another Saddam Hussein. I mean, you know, it's going to be another. It's either going to be a strong man, or you're going to have a Shiite theocracy. It's all or nothing. It's one or the other. It can't go in any other direction. It's just very, very clear to me. But the point is that this thing was under control. And George W. You go back, you read Bob Woodward's book, you know, his second book about Bush at war, and you go back to 2002. Late 2002, after 9/11, before the so-called decision had been made to go to war, although we learned today from the British that the decision had actually been made at that point. This was December of 2002. Karl Rove, according to Bob Woodward's book, shows up in Crawford, Texas, with his laptop computer and flips it open, has a PowerPoint presentation, and he says, "This is your reelection strategy." And the whole basis of his reelection strategy was that he was going to be a strong war president. He was going to be this warrior guy who, you know, is resolute and firm, and no president of the United States when the country is at war has ever failed to be reelected, and, you know, blah de blah de blah de blah de blah. And in my opinion, of his reelection campaign strategy, he saw the mistake his father made in pulling out of Iraq too early. You know, if Bush Sr. had just dragged that thing out another 3 or 4 months, he probably would have gotten reelected. And said, you know, I'm not going to make that mistake. We're going to have a good war, and it's going to. And he was being very optimistic. And at the same time, then you had the agenda of the neocons who are surrounding him. You know, the PNAC guys, Wolfowitz, Cheney, Jeb Bush, Don Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, Richard Feith, who were all saying, you know, we have to reshape the Middle East. You know, and you can impose democracy at the end of a barrel of a gun, even though it had never been successfully done. And it just falls apart.
It just seems to me, I'm fascinated because, of course, the right wing is trying to spin their way out of this, and they're just getting deeper. I mean, Biden got to the bottom of it by saying this certain amount of high explosives missing doesn't matter because there are so many high explosives all over that country that we have set loose.
That's right. It's the tip of the iceberg.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
Because they didn't do it in a rational fashion.
Absolutely not. And the thing is that this story is going to have legs at least till day after tomorrow. And if it does, then it's going to be the talk of Sunday, and then you're one day away from an election. I don't think they can spin their way out of this.
No, and you know why the story has legs, even though we agree, and here we are, you know, on the other side of the argument, right, from the president.
Yeah.
We agree that this is really not that big a deal in the larger context. But the reason that the story has legs is because it's emblematic, it's metaphorical, it's symbolic. This one event is symbolic of the larger event of the absolute incompetence of this administration and the way that they decided to conduct this war and the way that they decided to go in. And that's why it has legs, and that's why it's grabbed the imagination of the American people and people all around the world, frankly, in my opinion. Chris, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. We got to move along here. Tony in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tony, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Oh, I was just calling to talk about the 9/11 thing that you were saying. That guy was calling out on the conspiracy.
Oh, you mean was Paul Wellstone murdered? And if so, was he murdered by Cheney and Rumsfeld and these guys? You know.
No, the 9/11 thing. Oh, whether or not Bush.
Oh, whether or not Bush knew about 9/11. Okay, pick your conspiracy theory. Yeah.
A billion conspiracies to talk about, but Bush, like you said, went on the longest vacation of a. Presidential history.
Yeah.
And right during that, the head of CSG, Richard Clark, had canceled the vacations of every single person on his staff.
Right.
And also, the thing you said that I heard that they allocated $13 million funds or something for the 9/11 commission, but they also allowed $74 million to or $74 million to Ken Starr to investigate Monica Lewinsky.
That's right. That's right. It was between 74 and 80, depending on how you count it. Yeah. And various numbers on 9/11, depending on whether you include the congressional investigation or simply the 9/11 commission, runs from $3 to $15 million. But still, it's peanuts compared to what we paid for Ken Starr.
You'd think that'd throw up red flags, but I guess it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. It's not. You know, it doesn't get traction. It's numbers stuff. The right-wing talking machine, of course, which controls much of the discourse in America, and the daily memos, you know, that come down from Roger Ailes at Faux News, things like that. You're going to have more balance in the American media. The head of BBC today, one of the stories that it's in the stack here that I'm going to get down to at some point, but I'll just, you know, share it right now. The head of BBC yesterday came out and said, you know, the American press is not behaving like press. It's behaving like cheerleaders for the administration. And he didn't point it out, you know, exactly why, but there's a very good reason for that. And the reason is that the press is twofold. Number one, most of the press in the United States, or much of the press in the United States, is owned by very large corporations that are also in the defense industry or have interlocking boards with companies in the defense industries. And this is what Dwight Eisenhower was so concerned about and warned us about. And secondly, entertainment. News has become entertainment, and the people who are providing the news have become superstars, and they have become very wealthy superstars. Back in the days of Walter Cronkite and CBS in the 1960s was making like $75,000 a year. Nowadays, you've got correspondent. I mean, Keith Olbermann was talking the other day about how when he left Fox News a couple of years ago, they had to pay him $700,000 or $800,000 to go away, you know, for the rest of his salary for that year. These guys are not willing to risk that kind of a salary by asking the president such a hard question that he might not ever again ask them a question. So you end up with this suck-up mentality among the press. And that's one of the major problems. It's the problem of infotainment. The press, the media in the United States have lost their spine, lost their backbone, in part because of corporate control, in part because for many of them, it's more important to be a star than it is to be a reporter. It's just a tragedy, but it's real. 10 minutes before the hour.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research is responsible for the following message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor by any candidate's committee.
Hello, my name is Cindy, and I am a progressive. For many years, I've supported Ralph Nader, always admiring his many accomplishments. However, at this critical time, I cannot support his candidacy. You see, I have Parkinson's disease, and embryonic stem cell research may one day save my life. George W. Bush has severely restricted funding for stem cell research. He also threatens to jail doctors and scientists who want to use nuclear transfer research to cure debilitating diseases. On the other hand, John Kerry vows to remove President Bush's restrictions and to openly fund this vital research. Ralph Nader recently admitted that he has no chance to win this presidential election. A vote for Nader can only be a vote for Bush. Please don't throw your vote away. My life depends on it. Thank you.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Cities are losing the fight against traffic gridlock, and that's costing a lot of time, gas, and money. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Across America, roads have been widened and mass transit systems expanded, and more people are working on computers at home. But cities are still losing the battle against highway congestion. The Texas Transportation Institute reports that the time people spend sitting in rush hour traffic has nearly tripled since 1982. Tim Lomax is a research engineer and co-author of the Institute's 2004 Urban Mobility Report. He says growing traffic congestion represents a waste of time and resources.
The annual delay per commuter during the peak period has grown from 16 hours to 46 hours since 1982 up to 2002. The cost of congestion has gone up to $63 billion in 2002, and that includes that delay plus 5.6 billion gallons of wasted fuel due to the traffic jams.
Lomax says the average commuter burns as much as half a tank of gasoline each month while idling in gridlock.
On a per-person basis, for the folks in the 85 urban areas we deal with, it's an average of 74 gallons per year, something like 6 gallons a month.
Lomax says economic growth in urban areas is the main driver of traffic congestion. Cities everywhere are developing outward, boosting the number of commuters on clogged streets and freeways. Lomax says individuals can take a number of steps to cut congestion and save money, time, and stress. He says commuters should combine trips, carpool, and use alternative forms of transportation when possible, and he says drivers should make sure their cars are in sound mechanical order to avoid breakdowns in heavy traffic. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, video joints on every corner, 14 super discount stores, each one bigger than the last, with giant sales blowing out the doors. And I try to be so thrifty, but there's just no use pretending that I understand how I can save my money while I'm spending.
Oh, yeah. And then how to respond to 9/11? Go out and spend. Well, I don't know. Sam Adams in 1771 said, "The liberties of our country, the freedom of our civil constitution," our quote for the day, "are worth defending at all hazards. The duty to defend them against all attacks. We've received them as a fair inheritance from our worthy ancestors. They purchased them for us with toil and danger and expensive treasure and blood, and transmitted to us with care and diligence. It will bring an everlasting mark of infamy on the present generation, enlightened as it is, if we should suffer them to be wrested from us by violence without a struggle, or be cheated out of them by the artifices of false and designing men." Samuel Adams, 1771. 1-866-889-8894. Let's wrap up this hour with Michael from Santa Fe. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Not much. Just a few quick points. One, I'd like to say to the conspiracy theorists that say, you know, George Bush behind the attacks or knew about it, you know, let's cut it out. You know, does it help anybody? Even if it's true, it's, I don't believe it is. I think it's, you know, not helpful to furthering the political discourse. But I will say something about the Paul Wellstone investigation. I hope John Ashcroft is listening. But anyways, I graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1987 and went to work at the Pentagon in special weapons research department in the Pentagon. And at that time, we were working on and improving a system, a secret weapon system, that would send electromagnetic signals through the air to flying planes that would screw up their flight.
It's called EMP, electromagnetic pulse.
Right. And we would send these at massive wattages. I mean, just massive. And what we're researching on is how to send these more powerfully.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. military has this technology. And I was talking to a friend the other day, and they're using this in Colombia right now to bring down what they suspect are drug planes that are flying
right
through clouds.
Right, but just because the U.S. military has the technology doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. government
right
or military had
right
anything to do with killing Paul Wellstone. I mean, the,
right,
pretty
right
much
but
anything
I,
the military
right
has, the mob can get, other people can get. I mean, who knows? It's
right, right.
But it's a
right
possibility. You know, it's who knows?
Yeah, that's just, I'm just laying that out there. I'm
yep
not going to say no or yes, but there you go.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Michael. See, this is the kind of thing, and thanks for the call, this is the kind of thing that really deserves a more thorough, open, public investigation. Yeah, we can put these questions to rest. I mean, this guy wrote a book on it, so it's worthy of reading anyway. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where despair is not an option. Get active. Get out. Get out. If you're in a state where you can vote early, get out and vote early. If not, get ready for Tuesday. Line up your time off. Get down there and vote.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions, including a 10% pay cut, in an effort to help the airline deal with its reports to AirTran Holdings for $87.6 million. ATA says there will be minimal impact on passengers while ATA reorganizes its business. Layoff of 156 workers was announced by the airline last Thursday. United Airlines is shifting 650 telephone reservation jobs to India. Earlier this year, United outsourced 200 call center jobs to Nova Scotia and is planning to outsource more jobs at its Denver call center.
Norwegian oil workers who have been on strike for close to 4 months are back to work today. Members of the Federation of Oil Workers Union went on strike in July against the Norwegian Shipowners Association seeking job security. More than 200 workers began the strike, barely impacting the production of the world's third largest oil exporter. Unwilling to negotiate, the association locked down more than 200 other employees out of retribution. The union replied with close to 200 more workers striking on a major oil platform. The Norwegian government, who had the power to step in and force arbitration, chose to let the two sides duke it out on their own. However, when the association threatened to extend the lockout to more than 94 oil and gas service vessels by November 8th, the government was forced to step in. Workers returned to work today, preventing further possible cutbacks in the country's oil production. Stakes have been raised at two of Atlantic City's casinos currently involved in a strike, saying they will begin hiring replacement workers to fill positions. Seeking better wage and benefit terms, as well as a three-year contract, more than 10,000 workers, represented by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, walked off the job October 1st. Both sides say that talks are ongoing, but two of the four hotels currently on strike, Harrah's and Caesars, have started running ads in local papers seeking workers. David Strau, a spokesman for Harrah's, says the hotel has no choice. Dee Taylor, the Unite Here executive president of gaming, calls the move nuclear war and says it will just prolong the strike. Harrah's ad says that the hotel is seeking permanent replacement workers.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The AFL-CIO says job outsourcing is accelerating. Some 406,000 jobs will be exported to cheap overseas labor markets in 2004. That compares with 204,000 3 years ago. Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Washington have all been hit hard by jobs loss. Ohio has lost nearly 1 in 6 of its manufacturing jobs. Since 2001, America has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs and 850,000 professional service and information sector jobs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I had survived two previous rounds of layoffs, and then the third round got me. They wiped out my whole department. I was forced to stop paying credit card payments. I had to file bankruptcy. I had to be rushed to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy, for which I'm not insured. How can we be the only westernized country without national health care? I can't believe that this is the best we can do. There's got to be a better way. I'm voting for John Kerry.
Move On Pack is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
There's a huge, hulking, hairy beast lurking in the corner that the powers that be don't want you to notice. The draft. Oh, no, insists George W., we're not going to have a draft, period. But isn't he the same guy who also insisted that Saddam Hussein absolutely had weapons of mass destruction? Why would anyone take his word? Oh, say the talk show pundits, the fear that a draft is coming is just the same pundits that assured us that our troops would be greeted by grateful Iraqis throwing rose petals at them, and that those troops would be home in no time. Who trusts them? Every day, we see the reality in news reports of a war gone horribly bad, and of so-called leaders who don't have a clue as to what to do except throw more troops at it. Indeed, top military analysts concede that our troops will have to occupy that country for another 10 to 20 years. Meanwhile, Bush is already pushing his next war, this one in Iran. There's also that boiling pot in North Korea, a nation that really does have weapons of mass destruction. Plus, we're still in Afghanistan. There's the genocide in Darfur. We're sinking more troops into the jungle of Colombia. And we're constantly told to expect yet another major hit on America by Al-Qaeda. Where will the Bushites get the troops for all of this? Not by continuing to force current troops in Iraq to extend their stay. That's illegal conscription, and there's already rebellion within the ranks. The volunteer army? Guess what? Recruitment is way off now that potential volunteers see the Bushites' inept handling of their wars. Maybe George's military-aged daughters or the kids of Halliburton executives will suddenly step forward to volunteer for America. But don't hold your breath. This is Jim Hightower saying, just as George dodged the draft in his day, he's now dodging the very real prospect that he'll impose a new draft on this generation.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. Score power at Equifax.com.
Old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, true believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. It's about 7 minutes after the hour, third hour of our program. I wanted to bring on, let's kind of open this up, widen our view a little bit, and talk about what can we do? What are the possibilities? How does change happen in the United States? How has change historically happened? How does it happen now? And for that, one of the most eminently qualified people for that conversation, I think, is an old friend of mine, Paul Loeb, who is the author of a number of books, including Soul of a Citizen. And Paul, what's your most recent book?
The new one is The Impossible Will Take a Little While.
There you go.
Came out a couple months ago.
Yeah. Great.
And it's a book on political hope and persistence, yeah, and how to keep going, as you said.
Yep, and you wrote a brilliant piece for Working for Change. I think it was a few other places on the web. I saw it someplace else called The 100th Phone Call.
Yes.
And I wanted to talk with you about this stuff. What? First of all, in reading, I believe it was Soul of the Citizen, I forget which of your books I read this in, you told the story about Rosa Parks. And you set it up by first laying out the myth that most of us believe, and then telling the story. And I think that that's a story that has currency today. I think that it's worthy of repeating.
I think it has huge currency today.
I
actually, in both The Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible, Take a Little While, use this story. And what struck me is I was being interviewed on CNN, and Parks was on the show, and they introduced her and said, Rosa Parks started the civil rights movement. And I was just so upset because, if you know the story, as you do, she'd been a civil rights activist for 12 years at that point,
right,
with the NAACP. She'd gone to training sessions at a place called Highlander Center, a labor and civil rights center in Tennessee. She was the secretary of the local, and it didn't just happen out of nowhere. And the image that we have, and when we think about it, this is one of our few examples of citizen involvement that all of us think we know. And we think that she stepped out of nowhere, act alone, and instantly changed history. And the reality is she was part of a community, because we always are when we act for change. There was a whole host of other people, like a man who was active in the Sleeping Car Porters Union, a union organizer.
Plessy.
Who ultimately got Martin Luther King involved.
Yeah, and even before that, I mean, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, the Supreme Court case that didn't quite go the way that Plessy was hoping it would go. It institutionalized segregation in the United States all the way up to 1954. But Plessy...
There was a whole stream of people, yeah.
Yeah, Plessy wasn't just some guy who walked into the whites-only railroad car one day and decided to have it out with Ferguson, the railroad cop. It was a Rosa Parks kind of story. This guy was part of it was a freed slave. He was part of the abolitionist movement. He was very active. You know the story better than I.
Yeah,
I'm assuming.
And the interesting thing is, we like to sort of take these lone heroes and say, here they are acting in isolation,
yeah,
and maybe if any of us happen to become that heroic, we'll do the same. But of course, we don't. As opposed to saying, what's the key moment for Rosa Parks? Is it the stand on the bus? Well, that's the one we know. Or is it the first NAACP meeting she goes to?
Right.
Or is it her role as secretary? You don't see the network news cameras zeroing in saying, Rosa Parks is making history. She's taking minutes at a meeting. But those are the kinds of humble actions that build the institutions that later on go to create those huge historical turnabouts.
Right. So the story here is not, you know, let's burst people's bubbles about the lone hero, the Steve McQueen, John, you know, Dean, you know, James Dean, you know, the rebel without a cause.
Any of those folks, yeah.
Yeah. These archetypes that are... You know, you find them all the way, you know, back to King David. I mean, these archetypes of the one person who stood up and knocked down the giant. It's a nice archetype. But the reality is, when you actually start looking at these stories, that in virtually every case...
They're always grounded in community.
That's right.
And it's not to take away from the courage, because courageous actions matter. They matter immensely, I'd argue, in this political time. And, you know, it's a critical election. If George Bush loses, I would argue that it's going to be less because of what John Kerry did than what a whole lot of very ordinary citizens did in raising hard questions at a time when the dominant culture didn't necessarily want to hear it or wasn't necessarily receptive,
right,
but raised basic questions. And so,
yeah,
so courage matters, but it matters in community. And,
right,
and this is, you know, one of the core lessons of The Impossible It'll Take a Little While, is that time and time again, I mean, even you took a figure like Nelson Mandela when he's in jail in South Africa, what do they do to maintain their morale over 27 years? They connect to a community. They'll see a guard wrapping a sandwich in a newspaper, and they were forbidden newspapers, and they'll smuggle that newspaper under their shirt on a piece of toilet paper, pass it cell to cell. And it's all about trying to create a community where they can pass that story to let people know that they're not alone.
Right.
And
this at the same time.
Situation.
This at the same time that Dick Cheney was working in Congress to block any efforts to sanction South Africa for what they were doing to Nelson Mandela.
Which right, or even to request that they free Mandela.
Yeah.
It gives an indication of where he's coming from.
I'm just amazed at that little bit of Cheney's history. I mean, he was one of the more active people working against any sort of U.S., against the United States taking any sort of stand on the issue of Nelson Mandela. And you know, during his time in Congress, and
also opposing every conceivable Civil Rights Act.
Yes, and none of this stuff is raised ever. Why do you think that? You know, just to digress here a little bit from our topic, why do you think that is?
I think that there's a sort of odd deference towards those in authority, where we don't want to bring up the unseemly, and.
But there but Paul, on the right, I mean, they
there's no difference whatsoever.
You got Rush Limbaugh out there calling Robert Byrd Sheets Byrd because he was a member of the KKK when he was a teenager 70 years
right.
ago, you know. On the right, they have no problem with pointing out the history of people. Why is it that on the left that, you know, well, and you know, truth be told, actually Strom Thurmond's history was fairly well known and was never disputed and in fact even often got repeated. I think perhaps, frankly, it feeds into another one of our cultural archetypes, and that is the one of forgiveness and redemption. That somehow this person turned a corner, and Strom Thurmond was no longer that vitriolic racist.
Right.
And the question is, Dick Cheney isn't anymore. There is such
a thing as redemption, but it does demand work, and it does demand accountability for yourself. So I have a friend who was in the Nixon administration, a guy named Eagle Crow, hired G. Gordon Liddy originally in that administration, went to jail for Watergate. At the point that he was sentenced, said, "I recognize that we came within a hair's breadth of destroying democracy," and said recently to me, said, "The people in power now are even more ruthless and have even more contempt for democracy."
Well, that's what John Dean said. I mean, he wrote an entire book about it called Worse Than Watergate, about the Bush administration.
Exactly so, and this is the echo of my friend who's much less known but was part of that same administration. And I think that this friend of mine genuinely went through, I met him originally, it was a seminar with Marianne Williamson where he happened to be just a face in the crowd and asked people for forgiveness.
That's amazing.
And
I remember Eagle
what
Crow.
He done.
I remember Eagle Crow. I mean, he had a funky name, was hard to forget, but you know,
right.
he was not a low profile guy. I mean, when he was busted and when he was convicted, it was big national news.
It was major. Yeah, absolutely. And so he has actually turned his life, and people do that. But what happens then is you look at a Cheney, and there's no turn whatsoever. It's very consistent with the disenfranchisement of black voters all across the country that's going on right now, and it's part and parcel of a kind of ethic that sort of says certain people are worth heeding, certain people are not worth heeding, and we will squash their voices if we need to.
Well, Strom
so it's a
Thurmond,
kind of ethic of contempt.
Yeah, Strom Thurmond had openly and outspokenly condemned his own past behavior. George Wallace did the same. Robert Byrd has done the same. Are you suggesting that Dick Cheney has never apologized for all his years of opposition to the civil rights movement, to civil rights legislation?
No. And he has, and again, you know, it has to be more than just, oh, I did this wrong, but I'll continue to do the same kind of thing now.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's either apologized for it, nor has he shifted his fundamental path.
I know John Edwards.
Nor somebody like, I mean, Ashcroft, who made his career in part by preventing groups like that very radical group, the League of Women Voters, from registering voters in inner city St. Louis, putting every obstacle he could possibly put in the way as governor, vetoing a bill by the legislature that would have encouraged more registration. Why? Because he thought they might vote against him. And so, you know, part of the challenge,
did.
I mean, I talk, the book actually comes from a phrase of Billie Holiday. It's a song that says, "The difficult will do right now, the impossible will take a little while." And I'm always, particularly this week, thinking in two time frames. One is, the difficult is, get some accountability to this regime and get them out of office.
Yeah.
The impossible is then we tackle the hard questions like how do we actually build a just world? How do we deal with the legacy of 9/11? How do we live sustainably on the earth? And these are not impossible questions. They just take work and persistence.
Yeah.
And when I'm thinking about the difficult part of the task, part of what I have to recognize is that there is this really significant ethic of bullying in place that we have to stand up to. And when they run ads against a guy who lost two legs and an arm in Vietnam and Max Cleland and call him unpatriotic, that itself is an assault on democracy, and we have to make that an issue.
Yeah.
And the way that we do that, I think, is through all of us, again, it goes back to the distinction between the Rosa Parks myth of the one dramatic moment and all of us doing our humble task, which is, you know, if we're walking the precincts, making the phone calls, doing all those things that in the piece that you reference, I talk about walking, this is in 2000, I live in Washington State, and we had a Senate race that was decided by 2,200 votes, which, of course, nobody knew at the time that we knew it was going to be close. And I was walking four precincts, which is a lot, and it's about 600 houses, and you go up the stairs and down the stairs and up the stairs and down the stairs, and your knees start to hurt, even though I'm a runner in pretty good shape.
Well, it's good for your heart for, you know, old farts like us, Paul.
It's good for our heart. So it's good exercise, but I was tired, and there's a Nirvana song, Grandma, with the line, Grandma, Take Me Home, that was echoing in my head. And I really wanted to be someplace else, but I knew that it might matter.
Yeah.
And when it was that close, I later found out, I asked the state campaign, I said, well, how many volunteers were there? They said, 15,000 to 20,000 in a particular state. And I thought, well, every one of us, if we accounted for one-tenth of a vote each, and we knew that we accounted for more, that made the difference.
Right. So we have about a minute left here, Paul. So the take-home message of all this, the message that you want to share with our listeners in this last minute is what?
The message is that our actions matter. I mean, they can go to theimpossible.org and check out the book, which is a great resource. But they can also act in this coming week, and we, ordinary humans, are capable of changing history.
Yeah. And in
again
fact,
and again.
You know, as Margaret Mead, you know, it's become cliched now, but indeed, that's the only way it ever has changed, is by...
And that is indeed the only way. And,
yeah.
And the book is full of stories of these improbable victories. And they took persistence, vision, courage, being willing to recognize that even if we just broaden the base at any given moment, we are doing something. There's an amazing story from communist Czechoslovakia and Václav Havel describing the slow growth of this movement that overthrew a dictatorship, and it always started with courage.
Yeah, as it has in the United States, whether it was the abolition movement, the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and now the movement to return us back to democracy, to turn our mind, our eyes, our face back in the direction of a more democratic nation.
What happens in November is contingent on what we will do between now and then.
Yeah.
And what happens after then is also contingent on what we do.
In other words,
we need to remember that we have that power, which is how our democracy was established.
Yep. In other words, get active. Get out there. Get active. Paul Rogatlob. Paul, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And your website, again,
theimpossible.org.
Theimpossible.org. Paul Loeb's website. 20 minutes past the hour. It's a Tom Hartman program.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do they know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack and automatic security up.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do they know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social. 800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. All of the attention given to Halliburton and their no-bid contract in Iraq would make you think that it is not a regular practice. But a new report from the Center of Public Integrity reveals that at least $362 billion was spent on no-bid contracts by the Pentagon since 1998. But the Pentagon did not stop there, rewarding $255 billion in cost-plus contracts that allow companies to spend as much as they deem necessary on a job, including an agreed-upon profit.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
See, we got the numbers, but they got the voting machines. Gonna have to turn out like they never seen. Gonna have to win big, gonna have to win clean. No matter if it's Wesley Parker, Howard Dean, my man Curry.
Gonna have to win big, gonna have to win clean. Ah, man, 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. As mentioned earlier in the program, the commander of the U.S. forces who had visited this weapons dump outside of Baghdad back when we first took Iraq has now gone on the record and said it was just a pit stop. We didn't look around. We didn't investigate. We didn't even know that this was a site for weapons. So, you know, all those right-wing talking points from the last 24 hours, you can just kind of turn them backwards, you know, unscrew them and let them just dissipate because it's history. And, you know, of course, the larger picture is that we have kicked over the hornet's nest. We have created this, in my opinion, what is now a civil war. I think it's safe to say now that in the last 3 or 4 months in particular, that the so-called insurgents in Iraq have formed into factions, and various of these factions have started attacking Iraqis more frequently than they're attacking Americans or other coalition forces, you know, the 200 people from Nicaragua or whatever, we have a civil war on our hands now. I mean, it has already begun, and we're just refusing to acknowledge it. And here you've got Prime Minister Ayad Alawi saying that it was negligence on the part of the coalition forces that led to the murder of 50 of his, more or less 50 of his newly trained militia and newly trained police force, military police. I would say, well, yeah, it may well be negligence on our part, but it's a civil war in Iraq that really is to blame. And what brought that about? What brought that about was that we deposed a dictator without, in other words, we created this incredible power vacuum without appropriately filling the vacuum and without filling it fast enough and well enough. I mean, you know, when we did this in Japan and in Germany, we filled the vacuum instantly. We didn't do that, and then the rest of Europe, and we lost not a single soldier. We didn't lose, you know, not one American soldier was killed in Germany from the end of hostilities in back in 1945 until today. You know, as a result of hostile action, the same in Japan. The same in Bosnia, the same in Kosovo, because we did it right. We did it rationally. This administration did it wrong. They just blew it. I mean, setting aside whether they should have done it in the first place, which is a whole other argument, they blew it. And they blew it so bad that now Alawi is predicting, quote, you should see an escalation in terrorist attacks, end quote. In other words, Alawi knows that he's facing a civil war. And, you know, it's increasingly clear. Iraq's interior minister told angry politicians on Tuesday, this just came out, this story from Reuters. It was just published today. Iraq's interior minister told angry politicians on Tuesday 92 suicide car bombings had killed 567 people in Iraq since the interim government was appointed in June. This is Fala al-Nahib. He says his ministry is, you know, just can't handle it. He says the Iraqi police are not trained to combat terrorism. The Iraqi police force is trained to capture criminals and robbers. This is what he said. You know, in other words, we can't fight a civil war. We can't deal with this problem. Naguib said 152 people were reported kidnapped in September alone. We're only hearing about the kidnappings of Americans or Europeans. 152 people in 1 month, the last one that we have reports for. He said in August there were 645 attacks on Iraqi government institutions. This from the Iraqi, you know, from the Iraqi government itself. The Sunday Herald in Australia, the main Australian newspaper, the Sydney Sunday Herald. The increasing number of anti-coalition militias are believed to receive funds from wealthy Saudi donors. You are seeing a battle for a nation, and you're seeing the primary force in this is the Islamists primarily, and now it's primarily Shia being funded by Iran, and Sunnis being funded by Saudi Arabia. You see, this is a civil war scenario playing out right now in Iraq, and it is an absolute and utter disaster, and we have to do something quickly, or this thing is going to get even further out of control. And this administration, oh no, no problem. Dick Cheney saying, a wonderful success. 29 minutes past the hour.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. It's unclear how ATA Airlines' bankruptcy filing will affect its workers. The airline filed for bankruptcy on Tuesday, but will continue operating. ATA has 7,900 employees. The Association of Flight Attendants has accepted a $24 million package of concessions, including a 10% pay cut, in an effort to help the airline deal with its financial problems. ATA is the 10th largest airline in the U.S. It has sold some of its operations at Chicago Midway and New York's LaGuardia airports to AirTran Holdings for $87.6 million. ATA says there will be minimal impact on passengers while ATA reorganizes its business. The layoff of 156 workers was announced by the airline last Thursday. United Airlines is shifting 650 telephone reservation jobs to India. Earlier this year, United outsourced 200 call center jobs to Nova Scotia and is planning to outsource more jobs at its Denver call center.
Norwegian oil workers who have been on strike for close to 4 months are back to work today. Members of the Federation of Oil Workers Union went on strike in July against the Norwegian Shipowners Association seeking job security. More than 200 workers began the strike, barely impacting the production of the world's third largest oil exporter. Unwilling to negotiate, the association locked down more than 200 other employees out of retribution. The union replied with close to 200 more workers striking on a major oil platform. The Norwegian government, who had the power to step in and force arbitration, chose to let the two sides duke it out on their own. However, when the association threatened to extend the lockout to more than 94 oil and gas service vessels by November 8th, the government was forced to step in. Workers returned to work today, preventing further possible cutbacks in the country's oil. Stakes have been raised at two of Atlantic City's casinos currently involved in a strike, saying they will begin hiring replacement workers employers to fill positions. Seeking better wage and benefit terms, as well as a 3-year contract, more than 10,000 workers, represented by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, walked off the job October 1st. Both sides say that talks are ongoing, but two of the four hotels currently on strike, Harrah's and Caesars, have started running ads in local papers seeking workers. David Strau, a spokesman for Harrah's, says the hotel has no choice. D. Taylor, the Unite Here executive president of gaming, calls the move nuclear war and says it will just prolong the strike. Harrah's ad says that the hotel is seeking permanent replacement workers.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. The AFL-CIO says job outsourcing is accelerating. Some 406,000 jobs will be exported to cheap overseas labor markets in 2004. That compares with 204,000 3 years ago. Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Washington have all been hit hard by jobs loss. Ohio has lost nearly 1 in 6 of its manufacturing jobs. Since 2001, America has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs and 850,000 professional service and information sector jobs. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, the lunatic is in the White House. Excuse me. That's harsh. That's harsh. He's just not a good president. I mean, let's just leave it at that. We don't need to. It's 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What should we do in Iraq, you say? Well, first of all, I think Kurdistan in the north should be split off and given its autonomy and independence. The Kurds have been lobbying for their own nation forever, and they should have it. And it should include some of the oil-rich edge, northern edges of Iraq for them, number one. Number two, we should repeal the constitution that we imposed on Iraq. Unfortunately, Alawi's government has no control over this. They don't have the right to repeal the constitution that Bremer enforced on them. It can't be modified for 5 years. And this is illegal, first of all. Both the Geneva Accords and the Hague Convention say you can't impose a constitution on a nation. But we did. And the parts of that constitution that we need to change immediately are the parts that, number one, say there are no barriers to foreign trade. Now, why do you say, what is it, foreign trade? What does this have to do with? Here's what's going on. Iraqi industry has been savaged. It has been protected all these years, and all of a sudden the doors got kicked open and all this cheap stuff from overseas is coming into Iraq, and the local Iraqi, they can't make shoes anymore. They can't make clothes anymore. They can't make machine tools anymore. But the only thing they're left that they can make is bricks. And probably they're even importing bricks. I mean, you know, it's like they're local, the ability of local businesses to function has been devastated by this, as is happening in the United States. I mean, this was a neocon experiment. Let's create a libertarian utopia in Iraq. This is what Wolfowitz and Pearl and these guys had on their agenda, on their plate, all the way since the mid-1990s. And they did. They imposed it. They imposed a flat tax of 15%, flat income tax right across the board. So if you're a laborer, you're paying the same amount of taxes as somebody who's a multimillionaire. It's wrong. We should allow them to come up with their own taxation. It would probably become progressive taxation. We should, if we're going to rebuild the country, and I think that we have a moral imperative to, because we kicked it over. Colin Powell is right. We broke it. We own it. But frankly, I don't think we broke it. We own it. But we broke it. We need to pay for unbreaking it, and rebuilding the country. Instead of giving that money to American corporations, We should be giving that money to Iraqi companies. The Iraqis are capable of building their country. They have done it before. Every single building in Iraq was built by Iraqis. They know how to do this. They have engineering firms. They have architects. They have factories to make. They know they could rebuild their country. All we would have to do is say, here's the cash. Make it happen. And they could do it for 1/50th of what we're paying Halliburton and Bechtel to do it for. And in my opinion, if you took those simple steps, you would stop the civil war. You'd have a much greater probability of democracy happening, and we could get the heck out of there, because we have become a problem. We have become more of a problem than we could ever be a solution in Iraq. Simply our presence there is an irritant, not just in that country, but in the entire region, and now growingly all over the world. You've got Muslim insurgencies in Southeast Asia saying that they're fighting for Iraq. This is the problem. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Liz in New York City is on the line. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm actually upstate New York.
Oh, I'm sorry. Whereabouts upstate?
Orange County, New York.
Ah, beautiful country. You're about parallel to us. We're in Montpelier, Vermont here.
Yes, yes. Nice area there. My first time calling.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just reading about the 380 tons of weaponry.
Yeah.
And it's funny, the Human Rights Watch World Report in January warns about this. It's talking about the hypocrisy of going there for human rights issues, and we're not protecting the human rights issues there.
Right. This the report from 10 months ago.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's interesting there. It's one of the main obligations was law enforcement and protecting these weapons. And it says right here there's caches of weapons throughout the country that we weren't protecting. Instead, our interest was the Ministry of Oil protecting that.
Which we did. We did very well. I mean,
right.
it's still protected. It's never been hit. It's And the other thing that's ironic is that after we attacked Iraq, after we invaded Iraq, the United Nations, the IAEA, and the weapons inspectors said, we're willing to come back into the country.
Right.
And we'll take care of these sites for you. And Wolfowitz and Cheney and Pearl and Rumsfeld said, and Bush, of course, said, nah, we got this thing. We got this, we got this under control. It's our country now. We're going to take chance. We don't need no stinking UN help. And
right.
Here
and
we go.
Freedom, what is the comment? Freedom's untidy in defense of looting?
Yes, yes. Yes, it's so sad. I've got to find that audio clip. But the video of it was even better because he's waving his hands in the air and he's going, freedom is messy. It's untidy. I don't know why they keep playing that clip over and over again with that guy with a vase. It's untidy and it's deadly.
Right.
Is what's happened.
Right.
And it's not freedom, by the way.
Right. That's why the humans, right. Rights Watch is very concerned about that.
Yeah. And it's not freedom; it's called anarchy. That's what has been going on. And I know some very well intentioned and very ethical and very high standard anarchists, and even they would condemn this kind of anarchy. Liz, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Lots of interesting stuff going on. I want to get into the Sproles in a moment, but first let's take a call from Mike in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. The greater the power gets bigger, the U.S. power or any power, the more there's paranoia and there's more conspiracy, whether it's theoretical or real.
Sure.
But what's starting to make me wonder is we were attacked by 15 Saudi Arabians led by Osama bin Laden, and Saudi Arabia hasn't been really held accountable in any way, but we had troops there, we got them out, we put them in Iraq.
Right.
It's almost looking to me like the Bush family and the neocons and the Saudi Arabians are really kind of working together, and maybe they're actually even supporting the terrorists. 400 tons of explosives, maybe they want that to go to...
No, I really don't think so. I think that that's just incompetence. But the first part of what you were saying, have you seen Fahrenheit 9/11?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Bush family and the Saudis, it's over $1 billion has been transferred from the Saudis to the Bush family over the past 3 decades.
They're all supporting terrorism still to this day, out of Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we're not holding them accountable.
No, in fact, they're going backwards. They just cracked down this week on the pro-democracy movement within Saudi Arabia. They just threw into jail a couple of people who were, pro-democracy. They announced that they're not only not going to allow women to run for office in the upcoming elections, they're not going to allow women to vote.
All conspiracy theories aside, I always try to think, conspiracy theories are kind of way out there. But it's looking more, just to say it, maybe it's preposterous, but I think it looks to me like the Saudis, including Osama bin Laden, and the Bush family, are basically doing this together.
Well, I think, you know, yes and no.
Osama bin Laden's hands.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And keep in mind the history. After Osama bin Laden, with the help from the CIA, I mean, you know, we helped put together the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and we helped fund Osama bin Laden in throwing the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
Osama bin Laden is Bush's ally.
Well, he was viewed as our ally. That was back when Reagan was president and when George Bush Sr. was president. And when Osama bin Laden left Afghanistan and went back to Saudi Arabia, the conquering hero, the guy who had successfully expelled the Soviets from Afghanistan, he publicly lobbied the royal family of Saudi Arabia for to take the Saudi army or even his own Mujahideen army. He offered to finance the entire thing himself on Saddam Hussein. He wanted to declare war. He wanted Saudi Arabia to declare war against Iraq, and he wanted to take out Saddam Hussein. And he tried to do this. He tried to organize a militia on the border of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and that's when the Saudis threw him out of the country, and that's when he had to go to Yemen. And that was why, because he wanted to take out Saddam Hussein. And
I think Osama bin Laden and the Bush family are still allies.
And so, you know, well, whether or not they're allies, we have certainly, I mean, he wanted Saddam gone. Saddam is gone. He wanted the world united behind him, the Muslim world. It is happening very quickly. He's much more of a rock star around the planet than any other Islamic leader, and certainly more than A, democracy, or B, George W. Bush, or C, America.
And American troops are out of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and in fact, the two main points that he made in the 1997 interview with Peter Arnett, and in 1998 when he declared war on the United States in his fatwa that he issued, the two main points were, number one, he wanted infidels off Saudi soil. He wanted the soldiers that we put in 91 as a result of the Gulf War I, they actually went in late 1990. He wanted them off Saudi soil, number one. And number two, he felt that the price of oil, that we were sucking the wealth of Saudi Arabia out illegally and inappropriately because we were holding the price of oil down around $20, $25 a barrel. And he felt that the price of oil should more appropriately be somewhere between $50 and $200 a barrel.
Okay, and well, we're up to $50. And
we're headed for
$200. Benefit of the neocons, the Bush family, and the bin Ladens, and the Saudi Arabians.
Yeah, what a surprise. And see, I can see how this can all happen without any conspiracy, just plain old stupidity on the part of the Bush administration, that they were suckered on the one hand by bin Laden basically saying, please don't throw me in that briar patch, please don't attack me, please don't throw me in that briar patch, when that's exactly what he wanted. And then also by Iran, through their secret agent, Ahmad Chalabi, who was saying, oh, you go in and take out Saddam Hussein, that evil enemy of Iran, you know, that they fought a war with Iran, lost over a million young men fighting against Saddam Hussein. They couldn't take him out. So they send a secret agent, Chalabi, over here, and he starts sucking up to the neocons and says, if you take out Saddam Hussein, everybody's just going to love you. They're going to throw flowers at you. And Wolfowitz and Pearl and Cheney and Rumsfeld wanted to believe it so much that they were willing to set up the Office of Special Plans with Doug Feith in the Pentagon and ignore all evidence to the contrary. And boom, here we are. We've got this thing. We're letting the inmates run the asylum.
Something stinks, and you know, something stinks with this whole relationship. They didn't catch Osama bin Laden. They haven't done anything against the Saudis except capitulate to what they wanted, what they needed is to get the infidels out.
Yep.
They took Saddam Hussein out, which the Saudis wanted.
Yep. And last year, Saudi Arabia was running a deficit, their federal budget, because they have such wealthy benefits for their citizens, and particularly for members of the royal family. And there's, you know, tens of thousands of cousins now of the royal family. And this year, because oil is now at $50 a barrel or above it, they're going to show a $3.5 billion surplus. It's going to be the first time in four or five years.
Have a deficit.
Yeah,
and Bush and his family are going to move to Saudi Arabia and attack us again.
Well, you know, I'm not.
It's been a little bit preposterous.
I understand,
you know,
Michael.
These are preposterous times.
I agree. I'm not willing to go off that edge, but
just being preposterous.
Yeah,
but
I appreciate it. Yeah,
it looks a little bit funny.
It does. It does. Mike, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I wanted to tell you about the Sproules, Sprouls. Nathan Sproul group run. This from the Center for American Progress. Voter Outreach of America. You heard about this? If you haven't, you will. I guarantee you, over the next few months, this is going to be a big story. Voter Outreach of America. It's a Republican front group. It was set up by, run by a guy named Nathan Sproul. Now, who, you ask, is Nathan Sproul? Well, he's not just a flack for the RNC. He is the director of a company called Voyager Expanded Learning, one of these companies that is making a fortune off the No Child Left Behind Act, because the No Child Left Behind Act requires schools to have certain kinds of tests and certain kinds of, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And he set up a company to meet the needs of the schools with regard to this. There's controversy on the effectiveness of their curriculum. Most of the research that does exist has been conducted by people with connections to or financial interest in his company. But, you know, in fact, the university scholars who specialize in reading curriculum said it's flimsy and unscientific. But many education experts believe the research used to justify Voyager's claims of success were unscientific, produced very little results. Nevertheless, the U.S. Education Department led applicants for federal funding to believe that approval of their application would be speeded up if they indicated a preference for commercial programs, including Voyager. In other words, the federal government is funding this guy, the Republicans in this administration funding this guy, and they're doing it via the Education Department. And so he sets up this thing called Voter Outreach of America. And they hired a bunch of people, among them a guy named Tyrone Mrasek. And good old Tyrone, according to the L.A. Times, was given a written script to ask people whether they favored Bush or Senator John F. Kerry. He's going door to door. They set these things up in tables outside government office buildings, outside shopping malls, in front of supermarkets, and going door to door. He was given a written script to ask people whether they favored Bush or Kerry. To those favoring the Massachusetts senator, Mrasek replied that he was just taking a poll and thanked them for stopping. He was told to offer registrations to people who favored Bush, voter registration. If you're not, you'd like to register, and to tell them, quote, George Bush really needs your help this election, end quote. What, however, about the Democrats who said, well, I'm not really sure, or whatever, you know, and or, hey, it looks like you're registering people to vote. I'd like to register to vote. What do you do about them? Well, there was a backup plan for anyone who inadvertently signed up a Democrat. Outside Sproul's office, Mrasek, quote, found a stack of signed registrations for Democratic voters in a trash can, end quote. These people are going to show up at the polls on November 2nd, and in Oregon, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, in these states, just by Sproul. I mean, who knows what else is going on out there. And these people are going to show up at the polls, and they will not be registered to vote, these Democrats. And why is this guy walking around loose? Why is this not the lead story in the New York Times? Why is this is our democracy? And Ed Gillespie, former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie, and the RNC are just playing these awful games with it. It's we got to do something.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
A changing world economy has made it more difficult to forge global treaties on the environment. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. When the Montreal Protocol was created in 1987, it was hailed as a model treaty for dealing with international environmental issues. The protocol called for phasing out chemicals that damaged the Earth's high-altitude ozone layer. Ken Konka is co-editor of a new book called Green Planet Blues. Konka says the world has taken a step back from global accords.
We had the ozone agreement in the 1980s, and that led to a lot of optimism that we would be able to create global framework agreements on problems like biodiversity, climate change, the world's ocean, these sort of genuinely globally reaching problems and globally reaching systems. Well, the decade of the 1990s taught that in a rapidly restructuring world economy, that was simply not going to be possible. So there's been a bit of a stepping back from that, and I think where most of the energy is these days is on some of these more locally manifested problems that affect people's livelihoods.
Problems like water supplies, deforestation, and spreading deserts. Konka says efforts are focusing on these more local and regional scales.
We're in a perplexing situation where in some ways there's been progress, but that progress has largely been people starting to get issues on the agenda, people starting to get organized for change. At some point that has to start to translate into outcomes for people's livelihoods and outcomes for ecological health, or these localized issues in particular are only going to get more contentious.
Konka says global scale treaties will likely remain on the shelf as long as international environmental efforts stay focused on those more immediate local issues. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
For united we stand, divided we fall.
That's what we got to do. We have to work together to bring about a regime change in the United States peacefully and appropriately in a way that will set up this country for a future healthy democracy. 1-866-888-9894, telephone number, Ann in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Real quick, because I know you're about out of time.
You've got about 2 minutes.
A couple points. One, when you do the math, that all of the debt that Bush has managed to add in just his four years in office, you're looking at a little over $11,000 per person, and that's not counting accumulated interest. That's just the debt.
Right, and that's that includes, you know, fresh newly born babies.
Other thing, real quick, is MoveOn .org has a really good two hotlines. If you're having interference with your voting, or you're not getting your absentee ballot, or mysterious things or incorrect things are happening, they've got a hotline.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1-866-MY-VOTE-1.
My Vote 1, 1-866-MY-VOTE-1. Great.
And they said if you need immediate legal assistance, it's 1-866-OUR-VOTE.
Our Vote, O-U-R-V-O-T-E. That's great. And I'm assuming if you just go to moveon.org, you can find that if you forget.
Right. They've actually got a sheet you can print out that says election protection card. You can take it with you.
Yeah, that's great. And use your cell phone to call them from the line, as it were.
Right. But to mobilize this time around to make sure we don't get the election stolen, there any kind of issues or interference or shenanigans, they said call.
Yeah. Now, you have early voting there in Sarasota, don't you, Ann?
Yes.
Have you been down? Have you voted?
No, I'm trying to hit out there right now.
Yeah, so you haven't yet seen what the situation's like in your community.
It's about an hour wait. I know that.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. Three days in advance.
And they've just been packed. That's what I've been trying to do. I've been calling and checking, and they've just been packed every day.
Are they going to be open over the weekend?
No.
No, yeah. Okay, so there's 2 days. There's tomorrow and Monday, and of course Tuesday. 3 days. 3 days. 3 days of voting. 3 days of potential voting. Well, Ann, thanks for that information. MoveOn.org. That's great to know. Somehow that escaped my radar, and I'm glad you shared that with our listeners. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And also, thank you to Louise for producing our program today. Thank you to Ira Gravatt for engineering it, to Brad Walrod for our music, Brad in New York City, to Shelby LaPree for streaming us around the planet on radiopower.org and offering continuous moral support and encouragement, to Ben Burge for the great archives at whiterosesociety.org, to Mike Toth for our archives at tomhartman.com, to the folks in our chat room for showing up, to Jay for writing, composing, and producing our music, our theme, and to you for listening. It is much appreciated. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak.